It's a huge cost.
Farmer James Winslade. And that's it from us. I'm Charlotte Smith. The producer is Sarah Swadling. And Farming Today is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
On FM, on digital, and on BBC Sounds, you're listening to BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Friday, the 13th of February. Good morning, this is Today with Simon Jack and Justin Webb.
The headlines this morning, Sir Keir Starmer is heading to the Munich Security Conference for the first big transatlantic get-together since Donald Trump's threats over Greenland. Climate campaigners have criticised the American president for scrapping limits on greenhouse gas emissions in the US. We'll hear from a former member of his administration on why she supports the change.
It's a question of the burden on the economy that these regulations are causing, yes. And the burden of the economy results in higher prices.
And also in today's programme, what should teachers do when a child suggests to them that they want to change gender? There is new guidance. We will discuss it at 8:10. And Welsh speakers wanted.
The Welsh people who came first, they came here because they really wanted to keep the language alive and all the traditions. For us, it's like an honour to be a part of that.
We will hear from the linguist travelling across the globe to teach in Argentina. The BBC News is read this morning by Charles Carroll.
The Prime Minister will join more than 50 international leaders today at the Munich Security Conference in Germany, where Europe's relationship with the United States will be under further scrutiny. It's the first such meeting since President Trump outlined his plans to take control of Greenland, a move widely condemned by Washington's European allies. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who's leading the American delegation, said that the old world had gone and it was a new era in geopolitics. Our Europe editor, Katia Adler, reports.
This year's Munich Security Conference is hugely significant. It's the first big transatlantic get-together since Donald Trump threatened Danish sovereignty over Greenland and pledged economic sanctions against any other country that got in his way. How deeply and how long-term that damaged US-European relations will be under the microscope here. France's President Emmanuel Macron insists Europe must stand strong and separate from the US, while NATO Secretary-General, the former Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte, says transatlantic bonds are as close and imperative as ever. Many others in Europe feel the reality lies somewhere in between.
President Trump has abandoned a legal ruling which limits carbon dioxide emissions in the United States. The 2009 endangerment finding concluded that a range of greenhouse gases were a threat to public health. The Trump administration said revoking it would save Americans money. The former President Barack Obama warned that the move would make them less safe. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowland.
President Trump is calling this the largest act of deregulation in the history of the United States. The endangerment finding was a ruling made by the Obama administration back in 2009 that greenhouse gases are a danger to public health because of the climate change they cause and therefore should be regulated. Critics say any short-term cost savings for American consumers from scrapping the regulations will be outweighed by the longer-term impacts of climate change, and they've vowed to challenge the decision in court.
The right-of-centre Bangladesh Nationalist Party has won the crucial national election, the first since an uprising led by students ousted the authoritarian leader Sheikh Hasina in 2024. The BNP's leader, Tariq Rahman, is set to become Prime Minister, as our South Asia correspondent, Yogita Lamai, reports from Dhaka.
This is a big change of fortunes for Tariq Rahman, who spent 17 years in self-imposed exile in London after being jailed on corruption charges in Bangladesh. Thousands of the Bangladesh Nationalist Party members and supporters were also jailed, including the party's former leader, Mr. Rahman's mother, Khalida Zia, who died of an illness late last year. The BNP had said these were politically motivated charges brought against them by Sheikh Hasina and her Awami League. During his campaign, Tariq Rahman promised that democracy would be restored after years of authoritarian rule under Ms. Hasina, reviving the country's economy, bringing food prices in check, and generating jobs for Bangladesh's large young population are the big challenges facing the new government.
Here, the government is consulting on plans to ban vaping in cars carrying children, as well as in playgrounds and outside schools in England. It'll also be prohibited in all indoor spaces where smoking is already banned, including workplaces and public transport. Smoking outside hospitals will be outlawed, as it is already in the rest of the UK. Our correspondent Zoe O'Brien reports.
The ban will cover smoking cigarettes and using vapes or tobacco heating products in children's playgrounds, outside schools and in cars with young people if it's approved. The plan is subject to consultation, but the Department of Health said extending smoke-free zones would protect children from secondhand smoke. Outside hospitals and health facilities, vaping would still be allowed to support those trying to quit cigarettes. Wide open spaces and the outdoor areas of hospitality venues like pub gardens would also be exempt.
The FBI is doubling its reward to $100,000 for information leading to the location of Nancy Guthrie or the arrest and conviction of anyone involved in her disappearance. The 84-year-old mother of the US television presenter Savannah Guthrie is believed to have been kidnapped from her home in Arizona nearly 2 weeks ago. The government is planning to create the first official bathing site on the River Thames in London. The location at Teddington, near Kingston, is one of 13 new swimming spots in England that have been put forward for consultation. Official designation means that the Environment Agency would test the water about once a week during the summer and publish its findings. Archaeologists in Egypt have discovered an ancient sandstone shelter containing rock art dating back 10,000 years. Officials describe the 100-metre-long structure as an open-air natural museum of exceptional historical and artistic value. Galicia Sala reports.
The shelter's ceiling and walls feature vivid red and grey paintings depicting animals, symbols and scenes of daily life dating back as far as 10,000 BC. The mission also found stone tools and pottery fragments from different periods, suggesting the shelter served as a refuge from the elements for ancient Bedouins, Roman soldiers and early Muslims. The tourism minister, Sharif Fathi, says the site offers new evidence of civilizations that flourished in Sinai over millennia.
And a Second World War archive that belonged to Dame Vera Lynn has been acquired by the Imperial War Museum. She was credited with boosting morale with her radio show Sincerely Yours, which connected those fighting overseas with their loved ones at home. The archive includes her BBC contract and her diary from a 1944 tour of India.
Thanks very much indeed, Charles. It is 7 minutes past six. Chris Foulkes has the weather, and you promised us yesterday that things might be turning.
Oh, yes. Yes, they are, Simon. Do you know, yesterday Aberdeen actually saw half an hour of sunshine, the first sun for about 3 weeks or so. Today, well, for most of the country, we're off to a cloudy start to the day. It might well be bright just for a time across the far south of England, but otherwise, England, Wales, across southern Scotland and Northern Ireland, it's cloudy this morning with outbreaks of rain pretty widely, and not just rain. Across the hills of southern Scotland and up over the hills of northern England, we are seeing some snow. There'll be accumulations as well building in above 200 metres elevation, several centimetres for a time, which could bring some tricky travelling conditions across some of the cross-Pennine routes today. The A66 could struggle for a time this morning with slippy conditions over the tops. So ice is a hazard this morning. As we go on through the day, this zone of rain and a bit of hill snow will slip its way southwards. You could see a few flakes of snow falling across the North Midlands, North Wales later on today, and it will turn increasingly windy for Wales and southwest England later on today. That'll make it feel a little bit colder. Now, temperature-wise, quite widely, we're looking at highs of 4 to 6 Celsius, so it is a colder kind of day, but 9 to 11 across southern parts of England and southern Wales, where it will continue to be relatively mild. In Scotland, well, we've talked about the hill snow across the far south of the country. That will be clearing as we go through the morning. Northern Scotland, off to a sunny start to the day in a little bit of time, but it's very cold, minus 6 at the moment in the Highlands, and there will be snow showers for northern Scotland. These brighter conditions will spread to the rest of Scotland and eventually will reach Northern Ireland, the far north of England, later on this afternoon. Now, looking beyond that, I can promise you a largely dry and sunny day tomorrow after a cold and frosty start, but then we've got another round of hill snow coming our way as we head through Saturday night and into Sunday as well. That's the latest.
Well, thank you for that. 9 minutes past six is the time. Let's have our first look at the papers. The Guardian leading on the ousting of the UK's most senior civil servant, Sir Chris Wormald. It says Sir Keir Starmer was warned against the move because of recent high turnover in Downing Street. The Times reports that in an unprecedented move, senior civil servants told Sir Keir ministers would have to formally order a redundancy payment for Sir Chris because there were no clear and compelling reasons for him to be removed.
The Scottish Sun claims to have obtained details of the charges which Nicola Sturgeon's estranged husband Peter Morrell will face when he appears at the High Court in Glasgow next week. The paper says Mr Morrell is accused of embezzling around £459,000 from the Scottish National Party over a 12.5 period. According to the paper, the former SNP chief executive is accused of using the cash to buy items including cars, a motorhome, luxury goods and jewellery. Mr Morrell made no plea when he appeared at Edinburgh Sheriff Court last year and was granted bail. Police have since confirmed that Nicola Sturgeon is no longer under investigation.
Former Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner has called for more tax support for pubs. According to the Daily Telegraph, it describes the move as a fresh challenge to Sir Keir's leadership.
While the Times leads on new guidance for schools, which says pupils as young as four can change their gender only after parents have been consulted. The paper notes primary schools in particular are being told to exercise caution with the new guidance.
The Financial Times is one of the biggest champions of the London stock market. The asset manager Schroders has agreed a near £10 billion takeover by its US rival, Nuveen. Schroders, which was founded during the Napoleonic Wars, said that after several approaches, it had agreed a 612 pence a share offer.
And a woman whose car was damaged by a pothole was subjected to a lie detector test after claiming £87 in compensation from her local council, according to the Scottish Daily Mail. 73-year-old Carolyn Hornblow says an awesome automated phone call from the insurers of Dumfries and Galloway Council asked her a series of questions using AI software.
11 minutes past six.
Let's get more on that news that President Trump has abandoned an important legal ruling, which helps is the bedrock, really, of limiting carbon dioxide emissions in the US. I asked our correspondent, Simi Jalauso, exactly what he's done.
President Trump has revoked the endangerment finding, which was a scientific ruling that underpins all federal regulations on planet warming gas emissions. So it concluded that six greenhouse gases were a threat to public health and meant that certain regulations were placed on industries, including the car industries, power plants and the oil and gas sector.
Yeah. And what's, I mean, is this a cost of living policy? Is this, an ideological one to throw off the shackles of unwanted environmental legislation? What is the rationale behind it?
That is a good question. So when Donald Trump announced the repeal of this finding, he called it the largest act of deregulation in US history. So he called this finding a green new scam and said that it had nothing to do with public health. And he's always kind of leaned on the theory that climate change is a global problem. It's not a US problem. He says this move will make cars cheaper. It will save the country about $1 trillion. It will cut the price of energy and transport. But there has been no scientific evidence to support this repeal. And environmentalists are incredibly skeptical about this move that the president has made. Even former President Barack Obama, who introduced the measure, he said the move will leave Americans feeling less safe, less healthy, less able to fight climate change. And he says that this is just so the fossil fuel industry can make even more money.
Simi Jalauso talking to me a little earlier.
30 minutes past six. There are to be more bathing sites monitored by the Environment Agency. But should you swim in them? Well, not necessarily. Jenna Fisher is our environment correspondent, is on the line. Tell us first what's planned, Jenna.
Yeah, so there are about 450 official bathing water sites across England already. And they, as you said, get tested through the summer months about once a week and get given a rating based on the level of bacteria in the water. Excellent, good, sufficient, or poor, which means it doesn't meet the minimum standard for swimming. So what's important to understand is that these new designations that have been announced today, there are 13 new bathing sites. Well, that's not based on water quality, the water being really clean. It's other criteria, number of people using it, whether toilets are available nearby, whether the landowner is supportive of it. So today, one of those sites is this. Well, it's the first site on the River Thames in London near Teddington. For context, there are two other sites on the Thames in Oxfordshire. One is rated just sufficient, the other one poor water quality. So it's very possible that this new site will also fail. Now, among the other sites being announced today, there are you know, a mix of coastal locations and on rivers. So we've got East Beach in Bridport in Dorset, Pangbourne Meadow in Berkshire, which is said to have inspired The Wind in the Willows, as well as rivers in Cornwall, Yorkshire and Suffolk. It should be said that there has been an increase in the number of bathing sites in recent years, much of them freshwater sites. And it's those freshwater sites on rivers and lakes, they're the ones which are consistently getting poor ratings for the water quality.
But is the intention that those ratings improve? I mean, is the whole point of it that there is some sort of progress being made, or is it just that they designate the area and then see what happens?
Well, look, it gets monitored, and then if it's consistently failing, then the water company has to come together with the local authorities and the campaign groups to come up with a plan to in theory, get that water quality up to a decent standard. So, I mean, to be quite frank, there is a certain game that is played here by campaign groups. They push to get designation for a bathing water site because it brings with it this testing mechanism. Once a week, the environmental agency will go down there in the summer, and then that will give a framework, a reference point, if you like, for the campaign groups to then say, look, the local water company needs to start acting. We have definitive proof that things are not getting better here. So now we want to see real action.
Jonah Fisher, thank you.
Well, one of the world's most valuable AI companies is raising more money at a crazy valuation, or I'd say crazy, lofty valuation. Theo Leggett is here with more on that and the rest of the day's business news. Morning, Theo.
Morning, Simon. Morning, Justin. And that's right. The American firm Anthropic, the owner of the chatbot Claude, says it's raised $30 billion in new investment. And with that on board, it says the company as a whole is worth $380 billion. That's around £280 billion. With me to discuss this is Jane Sydenham. She's investment director at Rathbones. Good morning, Jane.
Good morning.
Jane, this is by any standard an eye-watering valuation, well clear of any company on the FTSE 100 share index. So what are investors gambling on here? What are they going to get?
So what they're really expecting is now to see, you know, a significant rollout of the use of these large language models across a whole, across lots and lots of different organizations and companies. So they're anticipating substantial future growth. I mean, the last time Anthropic raised money, the company valuation was considerably lower than it is now. This is a 110% jump from the valuation last time they raised money.
But Anthropic isn't alone here, is it? There are other AI companies which are also showing the same kind of valuations. Astra, £230 billion, I think.
Yes, and you know, OpenAI, $850 billion. I mean, you know, the numbers are eye-watering and growing rapidly at the moment.
Of course, it was Anthropic's addition of capabilities in areas like legal, marketing and finance that added a certain amount of fuel to the stock market sell-off we've seen in a number of sectors recently. So is this a company that's as much feared as admired?
Definitely. In terms of existing businesses, we're seeing a fear creeping into the market investors are beginning to question, you know, some of the business models of existing or incumbent companies. Are they going to be affected in a negative way by the use of AI? You know, is that going to start to put them under pressure? And as you say, you know, it sort of started with the sort of software sector. It's even gone through to real estate, transport yesterday, asset management. Lots of questions being asked about future business returns from these businesses in the future.
And also some worries about a bubble forming. I mean, the money that's been raised includes funding from the likes of Nvidia and Microsoft, who are also backing OpenAI. We've heard an awful lot about the sort of circular revolving door nature of AI investments, with AI companies investing in other AI companies. Are you worried of bubbles forming here?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are significant differences between the dot-com bubble, which really was a huge bubble, and where we are today. A lot of the businesses are making real money, producing significant cash flow, and that is different to that period in the past. Nevertheless, we know when companies start to invest in each other and raise significant amounts of debt, the risks are clearly rising, and, you know, the promise of returns then really does, the returns need to match up to the promise. And there is worry as to whether or not all of these businesses can make the returns that this investment is expecting.
Jane, thank you very much. That's Jane Sydenham, Investment Director at Rathbones. Now, should the EU and the UK cooperate more closely on defence? Well, the world has entered a period of wrecking ball politics. Those aren't my words, but those of an official report prepared for the Munich Security Conference, where global heads of state and leaders of the defence industry will be gathering today. This week, Chancellor Rachel Reeves said she strongly believes Britain's future is bound with Europe's, for economic reasons, but also on security and defence. And the Prime Minister has suggested that the UK would consider re-entering talks on the Security Action for Europe, or SAFE, fund. That's a £130 billion European defence scheme. Initial negotiations for the UK to join broke down late last year. We're joined now by Phil Civiter, Chief Executive of Thales UK. That's a global defence and technology group headquartered in France. It employs over 8,000 people here. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
Do you think closer integration between the EU and the UK, on defence at least, is needed?
Absolutely. In fact, I think we've got almost no choice here. We need to create an environment that creates greater alignment, greater cooperation across European defence to ensure that we can drive economies of scale. We can maximise the shared investment that's coming, avoid duplication, and at the same time, create a pace, the deterrent that we all need to see, that readiness, that cooperative readiness to protect us all. And at the same time, drive economic growth.
So you don't want a UK company building a sophisticated type of drone that's also being built by a European company. You don't want that kind of duplication. But it's not easy, is it? I mean, talks on joining this European fund, SAFE, broke down last year. The government said it wasn't good value for money.
I think when we talk about that alignment, we talk about that cooperation, there are many ways to achieve that. We can achieve that through SAFE, through what will be coming soon, which will be the European Investment Defence Programme, the EDIP. We'll see that through bilateral and multilateral agreements. All of these approaches give us the confidence to invest. And of course, an investment in defence drives economic growth. Here in the UK, the defence and security industry contributes already today about $27 billion to the UK economy, and that's going to grow. Enhanced by that also by $20 to $25 billion of exports. And of course, these are jobs created in all regions of the UK. Jobs in engineering, in shipbuilding, in welding, in high quality technical skills and software development. And certainly for Thales, we hired over 750 people last year.
But any talk of closer integration with Europe raises very difficult political questions. We've seen that time and time again. How do you get around that?
You get around that by being clear on that alignment. And I think that's certainly what we would hope to hear in the coming weeks and months. We want to see that when the Defence Investment Plan comes out. And we are, you know, everybody is pulling for that to come out sooner, because that will give us the clarity we need, the position about where we need to invest, where we need to build up the supply chain. And to doing that together as Europe can only mean we do that at a greater pace.
So is that being specific on where the cooperation is, so that those who are sceptical about more integration with Europe know that this is specifically about safety and security?
Exactly right. And, you know, we've seen that happen effectively in programmes already. There are already programmes like OCCAR, for example, where we've seen joint collaboration on delivering autonomous mine hunting platforms. These are great examples between France and the UK in working in nuclear. We can see already there are those foundations where greater cooperation can ensure that we maximise that shared investment, to ensure that we deliver at pace. And certainly for Thales, that means that we can execute faster than ever before.
Phil Civiter, Chief Executive of Thales UK, thank you very much indeed. Now, a big deal in the City of London. Founded in 1804, a year before the Battle of Trafalgar, the asset manager Schroders is one of the city's oldest names. But now it's going to be sold to the US giant Nuveen for £9.9 billion. This will create an asset management titan with about £1.8 trillion worth of assets under its control. In a way, we have been here before. Schroders' investment banking business was sold back in 2000 to the US giant Citigroup. And someone who worked on that deal during his time at Schroders was former City banker, now author Sir Philip Augur. Good morning, Sir Philip.
Good morning, Theo.
First of all, why is this deal happening? And what, Schroeder's made a pre-tax profit of £674 million last year. That's a lot of money. So why is it apparently vulnerable?
This is a strategic decision on the part of the Schroeder family. It's, as you say, a healthy business at the moment, returning good money for shareholders. But there's a long-term threat to the industry that Schroeder's is in. It's mainly an active fund manager, managing other people's money using people. The threat comes from technology, and it comes in two ways. It's computer-based index funds that match at a very low cost what the stock market is going to do. And then really tying in neatly to your earlier discussion, it's the threat from AI. People think that soon, I don't know, 5 years, whenever, robots will be doing a lot of the work that people do. And it's that strategic threat, I think, that has persuaded the Schroeder family to take what must have been a very painful decision for them to sell.
But why does the introduction of more and more AI taking over people, mean that a business like Schroeder's needs the backing of a US giant?
Scale is very important in this game. I mean, you've got two businesses that are around rank number 20 in global terms. You put the two together, you've got more capital to put to throw at the issue. You've got much better distribution means of accessing savers, and you've got complementary skills. Nuveen is good at one part of the market, private equity and bonds. Schroeder's is good at another part of the market, equities. You put the two together, you've got the complementary skills and the scale to compete, they hope.
And both sides of this deal say that the two companies are complementary, that their businesses don't overlap, so there won't need to be large-scale job losses. Do you agree with that?
I think for the moment, that's certainly true. The Nuveen have committed to, assuming the deal goes ahead, which I think it will, to retaining the Schroeder's brand, to retaining the big Schroeder's London office. They've said that if the business sort of relists, if it comes back onto the stock market, Nuveen plus Schroeder's, it will have a listing in London as well as the US. So I think, you know, there's every sign of commitment. But the threat, as we were saying earlier, comes less from the merger, but from creeping technology and AI in particular.
What does this tell us about the City of London's status? Because on the face of it, losing one of the biggest names, one of the biggest, oldest independent names in the city to a US company, it looks on the outside like a loss of prestige. Is it?
I think there's a bit of that. I mean, Schroeder's, after all, is a FTSE 100 company. But losing one on its own isn't a particularly serious issue, but it's part of an ongoing trend. But we have to be realistic here. That London lost its way to New York a quarter of a century ago. The financial services industry has become New York-centric. That doesn't mean there isn't a really important, valid role for the city as the European financial services capital. It's still a really important, profitable place to be. But we have to recognise the balance of power has changed. And this is kind of another brick in the wall.
Sir Philip Auger, thank you very much indeed. And I'll be back in an hour.
Theo, thank you for that. Let us turn at 27 minutes past six to Mike, who is not here in the studio, but is in a better place.
Yes, good morning from Edinburgh, Justin. On the eve of the Calcutta Cup, Scotland host England in the men's Six Nations at Murrayfield tomorrow. More on that to come. But first, football. And Arsenal missed the chance to go 6 points clear at the top of the Premier League last night. Mikel Arteta's side were held to a 1-1 draw at Brentford.
Well, we want to win it, so we feel like we dropped 2 points. Every opponent is very difficult. Credit to Brentford as well for what they do. And we keep going.
It leaves Manchester City just 4 points behind Arsenal in the Premier League. Elsewhere, Manchester United have one foot in the quarterfinals of the Women's Champions League after a comfortable 3-0 win away to Atletico Madrid. The second leg is at Old Trafford next Thursday. Meanwhile, Thomas Tuchel has extended his contract as England manager through to the next European Championship. The German took charge 12 months ago and his time at England had originally been set to end after this summer's World Cup. But the 52-year-old will now stay on until at least 2028.
I'm very proud, of course. I mean, the two main reasons I took the job and I was so happy about the job in the first place was the amazing group of players that I absolutely wanted to coach and wanted to be close with, and the support and the trust that I felt straight away from the federation. All these things have only grown stronger in the last year. We had a great campaign qualifying for the World Cup. So after this campaign, we started the talks again and felt that we want to both commit. The federation wanted to commit. I was happy to commit for two more years to complete the full cycle.
Next, to the Winter Olympics. Still no medal for Great Britain out in Milan Cortina, but could today be the day GB finally get on the podium? Matt Weston has a significant lead in the men's skeleton at the halfway stage. Here's Joe Curry.
Today, Matt Weston could deliver Team GB's first medal at the Games when he goes in the men's skeleton. He underlined his status as the world's best by setting a new track record in the heats. The two-time world champion put down a statement second run to become the only slider under 56 seconds in Cortina. His teammate Marcus Wyatt is in seventh, and Britain's curlers are also back in action this morning. The men take on Italy, whilst the women face Korea after lunch.
You can follow all of the Winter Olympic action, of course, on the BBC iPlayer later today. Finally, Rugby League. And if you were listening yesterday, you will have heard Delith Lloyd talking to the captain of the Super League debutants, York Knights. Well, they had a night to remember because the newly promoted side pulled off a big shock last night, beating the reigning champions and last year's treble winners, Hull KR, 19-18 in the opening game of the new season.
Proudest punch. We knew that if we were there or thereabouts, that you know all the pressure was on them, and then luckily for us, we were there. And you know, one thing, we've got a lot of self belief and a lot of connectivity, and you know, we'll back ourselves to the hilt if we're in a game to the end like that.
That is the coach of York Knights, Mark Applegarth, there. Congratulations to them. Off to a flyer in the new Super League season, and there are three more fixtures in the Super League later this evening.
Thank you, Mike. Just gone 6:30. There'll be some toxic talk next week.
What if I told you that the chemicals used to make our everyday products are accumulating inside our bodies right now?
We're finding it in our beer, our tea, our wine.
I'm Mark Miodovnik, and I'll be investigating these hidden substances. From PFAS, the forever chemicals in our food, water and cookware, to the microplastics we inhale and ingest every day.
There was no food I could find that didn't have the microplastics.
What harm are these chemicals doing, and can we avoid them? Toxic begins on Monday morning at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Time now is a spot before 28 minutes to 7. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Simon, Jack and Justin Webb, and Charles Carroll with the news.
Sir Keir Starmer is to hold talks with the leaders of France and Germany this afternoon at the annual Munich Security Conference, bringing together around 50 world leaders. They're expected to discuss European defence and relations with the United States at a time when President Trump's commitment to NATO has been called into question. The US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said that he would be honest with the European allies about the implications of significant changes in the world. President Trump has revoked a key scientific ruling from 2009, which said that greenhouse gases were a threat to public health. It's underpinned most federal action on tackling climate change since then. Mr. Trump's decision paves the way for the removal of federal limits on carbon emissions from vehicles and potentially from power plants. The former president, Barack Obama, said the change would make Americans less safe and less healthy. The leader of the right-of-centre Bangladesh Nationalist Party, Tariq Mahmoud, who lived in exile in London for 17 years, is to be the country's next prime minister. The party is on course to win a two-thirds majority in parliament after yesterday's election. It was the first vote since an uprising led by students toppled the authoritarian leader Sheikh Hasina, whose regime had imprisoned thousands of BNP members. The government here is consulting on plans to ban vaping in cars carrying children, as well as in playgrounds and outside schools in England. Vaping outside hospitals and health facilities would still be allowed, but smoking would be banned. The Egyptian government says archaeologists have uncovered a site of exceptional historical and artistic value in the Sinai Peninsula. The natural shelter features carvings and paintings on its rock ceilings and walls depicting animals, symbols and scenes of daily life from prehistoric times to the Islamic era. And the Imperial War Museum in London has acquired a trove of objects, letters and documents from the Second World War that belonged to Dame Vera Lynn. The late singer's archive includes hundreds of fan letters and a personal diary from her 1944 tour of India.
Thank you for that. 27 minutes to seven. According to the Times this morning, the Cabinet Secretary, Sir Chris Wormald, the latest man to leave Keir Starmer's Downing Street operation, is being paid more than £250,000 in compensation. Ian Watson's our political correspondent. It all feels, Ian, from that report and others, very messy.
Indeed it does, Justin. I think given Chris Wormald's 35-year career in the civil service and a salary approaching £200,000, it's not perhaps surprising that he'll get a payoff of that nature. Downing Street not confirming or denying that figure this morning. But as for the mess, well, we're told he's leaving by mutual consent, but the head of the Civil Service Union, the FDA, said he'd been undermined by anonymous briefings, by open speculation, which he described as a new low for this government. At one point yesterday, in fact, Downing Street couldn't even confirm whether he was still the Cabinet Secretary, was he in post or wasn't he? We found out later on in the afternoon that, in fact, he had gone. I guess from the government's point of view, he was appointed in December 2024, tasked with rewiring government. I think the Prime Minister thinks it remains unwired. But there's also this post-Mandelson clear-out as well, isn't there? The Chief of Staff has gone, the Director of Communications has gone, now the country's most senior civil servant. And there is obviously an inevitable political row about this. Kemi Badenoch has said that Chris Wormald has been thrown under a bus to save the Prime Minister's own skin. Rather less abrasively, Ed Davey was simply pondering who the Prime Minister would blame when there's no one left in number 10. So you can see that his opponents, outside and sometimes inside the Labour Party as well, are saying to the this is a question again of the Prime Minister's own judgment.
And at the moment, no replacement, but plenty of names in the frame, or some names in the frame, but not all of them without controversy themselves.
Absolutely. There's a current job share arrangement between three other permanent secretaries filling in for this, again adding to that impression of mess, Justin. But Downing Street say actually this is a tried and tested procedure, and you know, there's been this type of job sharing arrangement in the past. The candidate who seems to be the most likely replacement is Dame Antonia Romeo, who currently heads up the Home Office. She would be the first female cabinet secretary. But I think there are two issues around this. First, the Prime Minister could have appointed her a year ago. She was actually shortlisted and interviewed for this job, but he himself went for Chris Wormald. And as someone said over a previous Prime Ministerial sacking, Keir Starmer is very good at clearing up a mess of his own making. He had insisted on Wormald at the time. But there are questions too, if indeed it is Antonia Romeo, over how she would be appointed. Could it happen now without open competition, despite the government saying it wants enhanced vetting in the wake of the Peter Mandelson affair? That is possible, but they are saying that it would all be signed off by an independent civil service commission.
Ian, thank you. We will be talking to Gus O'Donnell, Lord O'Donnell, former cabinet secretary himself, in a quarter of an hour or so.
24 minutes to seven. For over 60 years, the Munich Security Conference mostly quietly got on with its business of convening ministers, defence experts, officials from the UN, NATO, etc. to discuss security matters. But last year, it exploded into the news. Frank Gardner is the BBC's security correspondent and is in Munich. And I don't know what you would call it, Frank. Was it a lecture? Was it an attack on Europe?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, he really harangued everybody here. I was in the in the building and watching sort of people jaws dropping, frankly, because he didn't talk about security. The kind of clue is in the name. This is the Munich Security Conference. Instead, he gave European leaders who were here a big lecture on immigration, on free speech. He went out of his way to go and meet the leader of the Alternative for Deutschland party, the far-right party, which has been invited to attend this year, right. People say, under pressure from the Trump administration. But this year we've got Marco Rubio, the U.S. Secretary of State, leading the U.S. Delegation. And he has hinted that he thinks his speech that he's going to give here is going to be well received. He's talking about it being an important moment, but he has cautioned, he said, the old world is gone. Mm. The world that he grew up in, he said, we live in a new era of geopolitics, and it's going to need all of us to re-examine what that looks like.
Yeah, we know what it looks like.
It means America pulling in its horns and concentrating much more on its own backyard.
And of course, we've had this tussle over Greenland. We've had that, you know, quite big speech by Mark Carney talking about ruptures and new alliances and the old are being done. So it is quite a sensitive moment for this conference.
Yes, it is. I mean, the big challenge, I think, well, the big challenge, of course, is how to navigate President Trump, because, you know, his demand to take Greenland from a NATO ally, Denmark, was just extraordinary. It was the latest in a sort of series of big differences that Europe has with the United States. But the big challenge, I think, really is defense. America is understandably feeling pretty peeved that for the last few decades it has carried European defense. It's paid the bulk of, or carried the, you know, done all the heavy lifting in terms of defense, while Europeans have spent that money on things like welfare, which are much needed, but American taxpayers have had enough of that, they're saying. So the challenge now, when there is, don't forget, a war still raging in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine, is how to build up and coordinate that defense and keep America in NATO. And interestingly, 16 former US ambassadors to NATO and military chiefs have very publicly called on America to stay in NATO, that it's not a charity. They're saying this is something that is good for America's own strategic interests. So please don't leave it.
Thank you, Frank Gardner, there, our BBC security correspondent out there in Munich.
20 to 7 is the time. Two men are going to be sentenced today for a plot to kill Jews in what police say would have been one of Britain's deadliest terrorist attacks. Rowan Bridge, our North of England reporter. Give us the background again of the case, Rowan.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, Justin, police said this could have been one of the worst terrorist atrocities in the UK if it had gone ahead. And the men's trial heard how they wanted to cause mass fatalities in a gun attack on Jewish people, and that their plan was to smuggle firearms, including AK-7 assault rifles, into the country. And those are weapons that are capable of firing hundreds of rounds a minute. Now, they hadn't identified a specific target, but they planned to attack a march against anti-Semitism in Manchester and then head to the north of the city, which is where the Jewish community is, and to kill more Jewish people there. And as part of the planning for this, they visited North Manchester and scouted out Jewish schools, shops, synagogues. At one point, Walid Sadawi, one of the plotters, suggested poisoning the water.
And they were motivated by what? We should say who they were, actually. Walid Sadawi and Ammar Hussein. They're described as Islamists. What is it? Did they tell the court why they wanted to do this?
No, I mean, the evidence that was presented in court was that it was described as they had a visceral dislike of Jewish people. I mean, the police said that their hatred of the Jewish community knew no bounds. They were committed Islamic supporters of IS. And that seemed to be their sort of motivation for this, just a sort of blind hatred of Jewish people fueled by propaganda from the Islamic State group. They were actually caught because Walid Sadawi was using Facebook to spread his extremist views, and he got a friend request from somebody who he thought was a fellow committed jihadist. In fact, they were an undercover operative, and that meant that the authorities were able to see exactly what was going on and had the men under surveillance for months. That meant ultimately this plot was never viable, but it led to their arrest and conviction. And as I say, police said that it showed what came out in court, showed the men's hatred of Jewish people knew no bounds, really.
Rowan Bridge, thank you.
Now, senior figures from the outsourcing firm Capita have told MPs the company was overwhelmed by a backlog of cases and unopened emails when it took over the running of the civil service pension scheme at the end of last year. The problems have left thousands of people short of money as they've been forced to wait months for their pension payments. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Sean Curran.
Many of us imagine that retirement will lead to less stress and more time to pursue hobbies and see friends. But thousands of recently retired civil servants have been spending large amounts of their free time on the phone, trying to find out what's happened to their pension.
If I ring up your helpline now, I'm not in one of those two priority cases. How long will I be waiting?
The average wait time last week for not in those priority cases was an hour and 55 minutes.
An hour and 45 minutes?
55, yes.
That was the Conservative MP Sir Geoffrey Clifton Brown questioning Chris Clements, the managing director at Capita Public Services. Capita took over the running of the civil service pension scheme in December. Thousands of people haven't received their pension payments, and this week the government said it had started handing out emergency loans to some retired civil servants. Yesterday, members of the cross-party Public Accounts Committee spent an hour and a half grilling Chris Clements and the chief executive of Capita Public Services, Richard Holroyd, who began his evidence with an apology.
This service is not meeting, in any sense, the service that Capita seeks to deliver or the pensioners and the members of this scheme deserve. And we absolutely recognise that.
He insisted that Capita was aware of the hardships suffered by some civil service pensioners.
We inherited a scheme that was in need of reform, and we have inherited a huge backlog of some 86,000 cases, some 16,000 unread emails.
The backlog currently stands at 120,000 cases. Chris Clements said Capita had almost doubled the number of people working on the situation and was focusing its efforts on helping people facing hardship.
Last week, if you indicated to us on the call centre that you were reporting a bereavement, then your average wait time was 47 seconds. If you indicated your call type was hardship, financial hardship, your average wait time was 4 minutes and 40 seconds. What that 43% of the calls we took last week were on those two priority lines. What that has meant is that if for people who are not on those two priority lines, there have had to be unacceptable waits, and I am very sorry for that.
A Labour member of the committee, Anna Dixon, said other members of the pension scheme were also suffering.
It matters too for somebody who's reduced their working hours and was expecting to be able to defer and be receiving regular payments. The person who's expecting a lump sum, the person who's just already retired and is expecting their, you know, regular pension payment. All of these people are in financial hardship because month to month they do not have the savings to just pay their bills.
Chris Clements said the aim was to answer all calls within 30 seconds by the end of this month. Geoffrey Clifton Brown asked about the case of 27-year-old Kiva Jennings.
A former employee of the HMRC who has terminal cancer and now months to live. From December last year, she'd been tracing Capita for her ill health retirement pension. This was paid almost immediately after her MP, quite rightly, Gregory Campbell, raised her case in PMQs. And Capita phoned Kiva 20 minutes after Mr. Campbell's invention. So did you only contact either of you, Kiva, because of the deep embarrassment brought upon you by Mr. Campbell?
Chris Clements said one of the 16,000 unread emails Capita had inherited was about Kiva Jennings's case.
Before PMQs, we had been notified by Cabinet Office of this case, and we had identified that there was no case and had begun to open a case that should have been there on inheritance. And as soon as we had the documents and could follow the scheme rules, we made the payment as fast as possible.
The MPs heard the most serious cases would be dealt with by the end of February, and a normal service would be up and running by the end of March. As the hearing drew to a close, Richard Holroyd repeated his apology to members of the scheme and said Capita owned the problem and would fix it.
Sean Curran reporting on yesterday in Parliament. 7:30 is the time. There is water everywhere at the moment, but we know as well that we could well have a drought by the summer. What do we do to adapt to our changing climate? What is the role of government? Emma Hardy is the Water and Floods Minister and is on the line. Morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on for the first time.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on. I want to talk in a second about that, about what we do with water and how we conserve it better and keep it better. But firstly, you've got an announcement this morning, haven't you, about swimming and swimming places. Tell us what it is that the government wants to happen now.
Well, this is all about restoring pride in people's communities and giving them a safe place to go and explore and swim. So we're announcing 30 new bathing water sites in England. So that gets the total to 464 across the country. One of them that's grabbed a lot of people's attention is the first designated bathing site on the River Thames, which is by Ham and Kingston. But there's also a bathing site for the Pangbourne Meadow, which is one of the areas that inspired the Wind in the Willows. So that's going to be designated. And designation matters because designation brings weekly testing by the Environment Agency, and it also means that you can help to identify the sources of pollution and then work with partners to obviously try to eliminate them. And because we've now got the Environment Agency with the biggest enforcement budget ever when it comes to looking at water pollution, they've got the tools they need to really grip this, because I know so many people love going wild swimming. Even in January and in February, yeah. People love going wild swimming.
But also they come on this programme and say, look, the water conditions are not what they should be, and we feel that we're not getting anywhere in putting pressure on the water companies to make it better. What can you say to them about the ability of a local community to change the situation if they have one of these designated bathing areas and it's not at the moment suitable for bathing? How quickly will they be able to get it suitable, and what teeth are there?
So we've already, they've improved from last year. So they're at 93% now, our good or acceptable standard. But obviously that means there are still some to go. So some of the changes we've introduced is the huge investment that's going into water companies over the next 5 years. They have to prioritise storm overflows at bathing water sites. So they prioritise bathing water sites and chalk streams as well, and sites of scientific special interest. So they will be done first when it comes to cleaning them up. One of the other actually big polluters on inland waterways is agriculture, and we've already set up a group, myself and the farming minister, talking to farming organisations and environmentalists and water companies together to sort of look at how do we tackle issues around agriculture pollution. But the white paper as well mentions highways runoff, because that can be a concern in some areas. So it's about having the data, understanding the sources, and then tackling them at source. Now, for some, it's easier. It's easier actually coastal. It's harder on inland waterways. But we've shown already there's been some progress, but there's obviously more to do. And as you know, we're determined to reduce sewage pollution by 50% within this 5 years.
You mentioned agriculture there. We were talking earlier in the week to farmers with waterlogged fields, and indeed properties pretty waterlogged as well, and them saying this is going to have a huge impact on crops and on goods for months to come. How much more do we need to do? How much more money will be available? How much more effort can be made available to help them?
You're right. It's so difficult for farmers. I was speaking to one on Tuesday. I went down to Somerset and he took me in the back of his trailer and the tractor around to show how, well, I mean, I wouldn't even say waterlogged. It was like a lake, the fields around his farm. And he was explaining to me the real difficulty he had, because he grazed cattle. So they were, at the moment, they're obviously inside. But the problem is, by the time the water goes, the grass hasn't had time to grow. So he's got to replant the grass. And he's explaining all of this situation to me.
And no insurance as well for crop damage. That's the other thing they said.
Yeah, it is very difficult. So I've been having conversations with the farming ministers to see what we can do. I mean, when it comes to the new rules for farming, the new flood funding formula that comes in from April, which is one that we've designed under this government, it does look in the formula about the impact on farmland, whereas previously it was more the number of properties impacted determined where you would spend money for flood defences. So for the first time, farmland will be taken into account, but obviously that's the way the formula is designed from April. So I think, you know, I do recognise it's really difficult, and I heard that, as I say, very passionately from the farmer I was talking to on Tuesday, and it's something I'm trying to have conversations with about what can be done, because you know, climate change is real, and we are going to continue to see these patterns of increased wet winters and very, very dry summers, and they've just gone through a drought in summer and now they're facing flooding in winter.
Emma Hardy, Water and Floods Minister, thank you very much for talking to us.
Now, the Cabinet Secretary is the most powerful civil servant in the land. He, and it always has been a he, is not a political advisor, but sits atop over 500,000 civil servants and gets the people's business done by the Whitehall machine. This is Chris Wormald, has become the shortest serving ever. He was forced out by Keir Starmer. The Civil Service Union, the FDA, said his treatment was a new low for this government. Lord O'Donnell, Gus O'Donnell, served as Cabinet Secretary under three Prime Ministers and here in the studio with us. Good morning to you, Lord O'Donnell. First of all, the relationship relationship between the Prime Minister and his Cabinet Secretary? How important is that? Is it a chemistry thing? How does it work?
It's a massively important thing because the Prime Minister needs to lay out very clearly what he wants the government to achieve, and then that's going to be agreed with the Cabinet Secretary, and then the Cabinet Secretary's job is to make it happen, make sure that the delivery is there. So, yes, you need trust between the two of those. I say that's the most important thing you need.
And there's a story saying that he was forced out, and it was basically ministers had to overrule the civil service and order a payment of £260,000as his, if you like, payoff. Now, that looks, this story in the Times today, now it looks a bit like the civil service are kind of saying, we don't think he should have been sacked at all, so we want you to, the ministers, to take responsibility for that. And, you know, you're doing this over our reluctant dead bodies, if you like.
Sure, but it's not that. Basically, what it is if this happens, right, the Prime Minister has every right to get rid of his Cabinet Secretary and to choose whoever he wants for his next Cabinet Secretary, right? That's very clear from the Cabinet Manual, in conjunction with the Civil Service Commissioner. The amount of payoff is determined by the HR department, turns on, you know, how many years he's been in there. So the person determining that money within the Cabinet Office actually reports to Chris. So there's a potential conflict of interest. So basically, the person that can say, actually, I think this is good value for money, the only person is the Prime Minister. So you ask for a direction from the Prime Minister to sign this off.
Okay.
Where it's shabby is the fact that we've got to this place and that they have briefed anonymously against the Cabinet Secretary, saying it's not working. They've been doing this for a long time. This is a process that this government, I'm afraid, is one of their biggest failings. You've seen it right from the start with Sue Gray, briefings against her, all the rest of it, right? This is the fundamental problem, and that is something the Prime Minister can solve by getting a grip on his special advisers.
Okay, so that's where it comes from. It's the Spads who are becoming too active, too well-known.
Well, I mean, look, really good Spads are really useful. I've worked with Ed Balls, Alistair Campbell, Jonathan Powell, right? If they're good, they understand their subject, they can make the relationship between ministers and civil servants work a lot better. Bad special advisors turn out to be second-rate PR people, can be disastrous. You saw it in the run-up to the budget. You know, it was a complete omni-shambles from a comms point of view, whatever you think about the economics of it. So that's where the Prime Minister must take responsibility and get a grip.
Now, you said the Prime Minister has every right to nominate a successor, pick who he wants. Does he? Should there be a proper vetting process, a proper process to stop the kind of things that happen, for example, with Peter Mandelson? And, you know, because obviously it looks like he's got an anointed favourite in Antonio Romeo. But Simon McDonald is saying, former permanent secretary of the Foreign Office, says we need to have a proper process.
As you expect, since I was on the panel last time, I can't go into individual people. Let me just say that the people that we put
forward... But there should be a panel, is that what you're saying?
No, what I'm saying is there was a panel, right? Mm. And that's... I don't know what process they're going to use. I don't know if I'll be involved in it. But you assess all these people and then we put them forward and then they've obviously got to get on with the Prime Minister. So there were individual interviews, all four who went forward, who are all excellent candidates in my view. And yes, there's due diligence. That's absolutely right. And there'll be... You know, investigation, and that's an important part of it. And I think the Mandelson lesson needs to make sure that we do that. But people have made some mistakes there. Like Chris Wormald, just, you know, the Mandelson thing happened just after he'd arrived.
I think he'd been there 4 days.
Ollie Robbins was like involved in this. Ollie Robbins wasn't appointed before Peter Mandelson was appointed. You know, there's some ridiculous stuff out there that needs to be put
right. Does that mean it's not working, that too much stuff is falling between the cracks? Has the civil service been hollowed out?
No, I would say the civil service, there are some amazingly good people in there. Yes, some very good people have left because, you know, over the last decades, we found that trust has diminished and there's too much briefing going on against civil servants who will not respond. We turn the other cheek. So, yes, the relationship is not as good as it should be, right. But there are still some great people there. And this country is in a really strong position, right? Let's be clear about that. Private sector is really strong. We can do, you know, they've got 3+ years with a great big majority. Okay. This could be a great time to move on. So if we get this right, then it will be, you know, time to really move forward.
Gus O'Donnell, Lord O'Donnell, thank you.
7:03, appearing on Radio 4 later today.
What if, tomorrow, something essential to our world simply disappeared? Join me, Alan Davis, as I sit down with some of the brightest minds to reveal what would really unfold if the unthinkable were to become real. From the moon to a life without worms, bees, or sex, what would really happen if the foundations of life were suddenly pulled away? Life Without, with me, Alan Davis, starts this afternoon at 2:45. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
To the weather and Chris Folks.
Simon, we get off to a bright start across the south of England, but otherwise, England, Wales, Northern Ireland, southern Scotland, it's a cloudy start to the morning with widespread outbreaks of rain. It's also cold enough to bring some snow across parts of southern Scotland and northern England, especially to the hills, where we're looking at some accumulations building up 2 to 5 centimetres above 200 metres elevation or so, and some tricky travelling conditions around the Cross Pennine routes. I think the A66 likely to struggle. I'd definitely advise checking on conditions before heading out on a journey that way this morning. For the far north of Scotland, it's brighter with some sunshine. A welcome change in Aberdeen after, 3 weeks of gloom and rain. Yeah, sunshine for most of the day, but it's cold. Got a frosty start, -7 at the moment in the Highlands. Temperatures continue to drop here, actually. And we've got some snow showers as well. Now, these brighter conditions across the far north of Scotland will spread across the rest of Scotland. We'll reach Northern Ireland and the far north of England later on this afternoon. It is a colder day for most of us. Temperatures 4 to 6 Celsius, but still relatively mild in the south of both England and Wales with 9 to 11 degrees. Your top temperatures tomorrow should be dry and sunny for most after a cold and frosty start.
Chris, thank you. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Simon Jack and Justin Webb.
It's 7 o'clock on Friday the 13th of February. The headlines this morning. Sir Keir Starmer is heading to Munich for the first big transatlantic summit since the row over American threats to take control of Greenland. Climate campaigners say they will fight Donald Trump's move to scrap limits on greenhouse gas emissions in the US. And the government is consulting on plans to ban vaping in cars carrying children in England.
Also in this hour, Welsh teachers wanted.
The Welsh people who came first, they came here because they really wanted to keep the language alive and all the traditions. For us, it's like an honour to be a part of that.
We hear from the linguist travelling across the globe to teach in Argentina and Michael Morpurgo on his love of Robert Louis Stevenson's classic Treasure Island.
That's what's wonderful about it. He leads you on and leads you on. You become the people. That's the great thing about fiction writing. He sustains suspense.
The BBC News is read this morning by Charles Carroll.
The Prime Minister will join more than 50 international leaders today at the Munich Security Conference in Germany, where Europe's relationship with the US will be under further scrutiny. It's the first such meeting since President Trump outlined his plans to take control of Greenland, a move widely condemned by Washington's European allies. The US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who's leading the American delegation, said the old world had gone and everyone would have to re-examine their roles in a new era of geopolitics. Our Europe editor, Katia Adler, reports.
This year's Munich Security Conference is hugely significant. It's the first big transatlantic get-together since Donald Trump threatened Danish sovereignty over Greenland and pledged economic sanctions against any other country that got in his way. How deeply and how long-term that damaged US-European relations will be under the microscope here. France's President Emmanuel Macron insists Europe must stand strong and separate from the US, while NATO Secretary General, the former Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte, says transatlantic bonds are as close and imperative as ever. Many others in Europe feel the reality lies somewhere in between. It's seen as significant that the White House chose to be represented here by the US Secretary of State rather than the US Vice President, as is customary at these Munich meetings. Marco Rubio is viewed as a more conciliatory figure than J.D. Vance when it comes to relations with Europe.
President Trump has abandoned a legal ruling which limits carbon dioxide emissions in the US. The 2009 endangerment finding concluded that a range of greenhouse gases were a threat to public health. The Trump administration said revoking it would save Americans money. The former president, Barack Obama, warned that the move would make them less safe. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
President Trump is calling this the largest act of deregulation in the history of the United States. The endangerment finding was a ruling made by the Obama administration back in 2009 that greenhouse gases are a danger to public health because of the climate change they cause and therefore should be regulated. Critics say any short-term cost savings for American consumers from scrapping the regulations will be outweighed by the longer-term impacts of climate change, and they've vowed to challenge the decision in court. The US announcement comes as new figures show that after decades of rapid growth, China's carbon dioxide emissions have fallen over a full year for the first time.
The government is consulting on plans to ban vaping in cars carrying children, as well as in playgrounds and outside schools in England. It'll also be prohibited in all indoor spaces where smoking is already banned, including workplaces and public transport. Smoking outside hospitals will be outlawed, as it already is in the rest of the UK. Our correspondent Zoe O'Brien reports.
The ban will cover smoking cigarettes and using vapes or tobacco heating products in children's playgrounds, outside schools and in cars with young people if it's approved. The plan is subject to consultation, but the Department of Health said extending smoke-free zones would protect children from secondhand smoke. Outside hospitals and health facilities, vaping would still be allowed to support those trying to quit cigarettes. Wide open spaces and the outdoor areas of hospitality venues like pub gardens would also be exempt. England's chief medical officer, Professor Sir Chris Whitty, said secondhand smoke could cause significant harm. The health secretary, Wes Streeting, said no child in a playground or hospital patient should suffer because someone else chose to smoke.
The right-of-centre Bangladesh Nationalist Party has won a landslide win in the crucial national election, the first since a mass student uprising ousted the country's longest-serving Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, in 2024. The BNP's leader, Tariq Rahman, is set to become the new Prime Minister, as our South Asia correspondent, Yogita Lemay, reports from Dhaka.
This is a big change of fortunes for Tariq Rahman, who spent 17 years in self-imposed exile in London after being jailed on corruption charges in Bangladesh. Thousands of the Bangladesh Nationalist Party members and supporters were also jailed, including the party's former leader, Mr. Rahman's mother, Khalida Zia, who died of an illness late last year. The BNP had said these were politically motivated charges brought against them by Sheikh Hasina and her Awami League. During his campaign, Tariq Rahman promised that democracy would be restored after years of authoritarian rule under Ms. Hasina. Reviving the country's economy, bringing food prices in check, and generating jobs for Bangladesh's large young population are the big challenges facing the new government.
The FBI is doubling its reward to $100,000 for information leading to the location of Nancy Guthrie or the arrest and conviction of anyone involved in her disappearance. The 84-year-old mother of the US television presenter Savannah Guthrie is believed to have been kidnapped from her home in Arizona nearly 2 weeks ago. The government is planning to create the first official bathing site on the River Thames in London. The location at Teddington, near Kingston, is one of 13 new swimming spots in England that have been put forward for consultation. Others include New Brighton Beach at the mouth of the Mersey and West Bay in Dorset. Here's our environment correspondent, Jonah Fisher.
Just because a site has been officially designated for bathing doesn't mean the water is clean enough to swim in. What it does mean is that the Environment Agency will, during the summer, test the water about once a week and publish its findings. Last year, out of nearly 450 official bathing sites tested, most of them on the coast, 32 were rated poor. The new sites being proposed for this summer include, for the first time, a London site on the Thames, as well as spots along rivers in Cornwall, Yorkshire, Suffolk and Berkshire. Recent years have seen a big increase in the number of freshwater bathing sites being designated and tested, in part because campaigners want to put pressure on water companies to cut sewage discharges and improve water quality.
A Second World War archive that belonged to Dame Vera Lynn has been acquired by the Imperial War Museum in London. The singer died in 2020 at the age of 103. Kate Moore has been finding out about the trove left by the woman who was known as the Force's sweetheart.
There'll be blue.
Vera Lynn made her name during the Second World War.
She was credited with boosting morale with her radio show, Sincerely Yours, which connected those fighting overseas with their loved ones at home. Her archive includes her BBC contract, as well as her diary from a 1944 tour of India, one of several trips during which she gave concerts for the troops, singing her hits including We'll Meet Again and The White Cliffs of Dover. There are also more than 600 fan letters, letters from her husband and her tour uniforms. The museum says Dame Vera's music and wartime service made her a symbol of hope, and it was proud to preserve her legacy. The archive will eventually go on public display.
And archaeologists in Egypt have discovered an ancient sandstone shelter containing rock art that dates back 10,000 years. The ceiling and walls of the 100-metre-long structure feature red and grey paintings depicting animals, symbols and scenes of daily life, dating back as far as 10,000 BC. Stone tools and pottery fragments suggest it was used by ancient Bedouins, Roman soldiers and early Muslims.
Thank you, Charles. It is 9 minutes past seven. Good morning to you on this Friday the 13th. As you were hearing in the headlines there, Donald Trump has swept away environmental legislation from the Obama and Joe Biden eras. He's abandoned a scientific ruling that defined greenhouse gases, including carbon dioxide, as pollutants harmful to public health. So this ruling formed the bedrock of rules around emissions from things like cars and power plants and other emitters. John Kerry, who was Secretary of State under Barack Obama from 2013 to 2017, spoke to the BBC overnight and gave this reaction to the news.
This is like putting a lit match on the kindling of climate-exacerbated hurricanes, fires, droughts that now kill people and now ring up an average bill of $182 billion annually in climate disasters.
Well, Diana Furch-Todd-Roth is a distinguished fellow at the Energy Policy Research Foundation. She was in the Transport Department during the Trump's first administration. I asked her a little earlier why Donald Trump has made this decision.
What President Trump says is that these rules raise the prices of cars and raise the prices of energy. And what was rolled back specifically on Thursday was the endangerment finding as regards to cars. We're going to expect a similar one with power plants, because if you require power plants to bury 90% of their carbon emissions or else close down, that raises the price of electricity.
It's a cost of living thing. It's basically, he thinks that cars will be cheaper, electricity will be cheaper in the short term, potentially. Others would argue, obviously, that wind is cheaper than burning stuff, and that eventually that the long-term cost of renewables will be lower. But this is a cost of living appeal to the American voter.
It's a question of the burden on the economy that these regulations are causing, yes. And the burden of the economy results in higher prices. And manufacturing has left. It's gone to China, where it's made in a dirtier way. Right. So to say that we're reducing global emissions by ending energy-intensive manufacturing in some countries, then having it go to China and India, where it's made in a dirtier way, does not reduce global emissions. The harms from climate change are risks for the future, but we have poor people now, and President Trump wants to concentrate on alleviating poverty here now, not just here, but in other countries around the world.
That's an argument for never. That's an argument for never doing anything, isn't it? I mean, that will always be the case, and you have to think about the future. There's a sort of selflessness that's required when it comes to long-term climate planning here and climate protection.
Well, only if we're sure that it's going to happen. Temperatures have not increased as much as forecast. The sea has not risen as much as forecast.
Okay.
And a lot of people like it a bit warmer.
Let's not have the climate debate. Let's talk about the actual policy and its implications. Now, a lot of people say these cars, you know, America would like to export cars. These cars are going to be harder to export to countries which do have some environmental protections in. So that is bad for US manufacturers if they want to do more manufacturing for the rest of the world.
Well, you can also see that these car manufacturers in Europe are taking in large amounts of Chinese vehicles, including electric vehicles, and they are having to make redundant the auto workers, the car workers who work on those plants. Volkswagen, for example, has declared redundancies in three different car plants in Germany because of the influx of Chinese EVs.
But doesn't the success of China's electric vehicle market and their manufacturers illustrate that the appetite for low-emission electric vehicles is very apparent? That's the economic opportunity.
If you ask normal people around Europe and the UK, not the elite, they would say that these cars are very expensive. You have to wait a long time to charge them up. You have to spend a lot of money when they break down to repair them. And I think normal people want the normal petrol-powered cars.
That was Diana Furch-Todroth, a fellow at the Energy Policy Research Foundation and was a member of Trump's first administration.
7:30 is the time. The Munich Security Conference opens today. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio is the keynote US speaker, not J.D. Vance, who used his speech, of course, last year to employ a verbal flamethrower, accusing Europe of imperiling Western civilization. Rubio tends to be a more emollient character, it is fair to say. But, of course, this is the first conference since the Greenland spat. So there's plenty of trouble that could be had. Katja Adler, our Europe editor, is there in Munich already for us. Set the scene, Katja.
Well, great expectations, I would say. It's really, really significant for the Europeans that this is going to be the first. Well, it's a global get-together, isn't it? The biggest security conference in the world, but the first real transatlantic get-together since what you call the Greenland spat. I mean, listening to Europeans here, it's really far from a spat. It's seen as, you know, a watershed moment where not the end of transatlantic relations, but a huge loss of trust. How long term that loss of trust is and what Europeans are going to do going forward, that will also come under the microscope, not just Marco Rubio's speech here. And you won't be surprised to hear that there are divisions amongst the Europeans, Justin. I mean, you've got Emmanuel Macron on the one side. He'll be speaking today, so will the host, the German Chancellor as well. But Macron particularly is saying Europe needs to stand strong and separate from the United States, whereas we're going to hear also from the NATO Secretary General, who's, of course, the former Dutch Prime Minister, who says, Mark Rutte, there's nothing to see here. The relations, transatlantic relations, are just as strong as ever. Most people here think it's somewhere in between. But yes, everybody wants to listen to Marco Rubio tomorrow. And it's seen as very significant that his more emollient style was chosen by Washington to represent the White House here rather than J.D. Vance. I mean, he was just down the road a few days ago at the opening of the Olympics in Italy, so he could have stayed.
And President Zelensky, of course. I mean, there is a war going on, never mind what future wars and conflicts there might be. There is a war, of course, going on at the moment. President Zelensky will be there, presumably, hearing what?
He'll be here and hoping that he's not been forgotten, because around the whole Greenland issue, Ukraine very much felt sort of put on the back burner. Ukraine doesn't want Europe to forget its fate. It doesn't want the United States to get irritated with how slow peace talks are going. Of course, President Trump has said he wants an end to this conflict by May or June. What President Zelensky will be saying here to this, you know, there's a vast amount of US presence here. Also, the other side of the United States, Justin, Governor of California, Gavin Newsom, is here, seen as a probable presidential hopeful for the Democrats. Germany's Chancellor is meeting him today. President Zelensky wants that whoever is going to be in Washington, who's there now and in the future, won't forget Ukraine and will protect it against future Russian aggression. So he will be sort of pressing the flesh here and concentrating on that and hoping that he can stay front of mind. Iran also, you know, will be a big focus of attention. But for the Europeans, this really is about transatlantic relations. The reality, you can't just say goodbye to the United States, but how closely can you work together and how independent can the Europeans be, not just in terms of defence, but in terms of technology and industry as well going forward.
And on Greenland, that specific issue, is it settled?
No, it's not settled. So talks are going on at the moment still between Denmark, Greenland and the United States, but without much noise coming from it. So Greenlanders are still worried that this issue can come back to haunt them, that even though Donald Trump, the fire and the fury went away. I mean, you'll remember he didn't rule out at the time taking Greenland by force. He also threatened economic sanctions on countries that got in his way, and that would have included the UK at the time. That's gone quiet for now, but neither the Europeans nor the Greenlanders themselves think that this might go away forever if Donald Trump doesn't get as much control over Greenland as he wants. You had a meeting this week in Brussels in NATO of foreign ministers where the Europeans said, look, you know, we are really boosting our presence. The UK said as well, massively boosting our presence in the high north, in the Arctic, hoping to assuage Donald Trump's fears that there's not enough security presence around Greenland and elsewhere in the Arctic. But of course, there were question marks as to why he really wants such a US presence or control over Greenland, and therefore whether this issue will go away in the long term. As Europeans have got used to with Washington, just a lot of question marks, which again is why they're waiting for Marco Rubio's speech tomorrow with bated breath.
Katja Adler in Munich. Thank you.
18 minutes past seven, time for some business and some bumper profits at the bank NatWest. Theo.
Thanks, Simon. Yes, that's right. They've reported a pre-tax profit of £7.7 billion for 2025. That's up from £6.2 billion the year before. And it all caps off what's really been a big year for NatWest. In May, it returned to private ownership after the government sold the last of the stake it took in the wake of the global financial crisis. And just this week, it announced the purchase of wealth manager Evelyn Partners for £2.7 billion. With me to discuss this morning is Russ Mould, Investment Director for AJ Bell. Morning, Russ.
Good morning, Theo.
What do you make of these results? They seem pretty good on the face of it.
They're extremely good, and they're certainly better than analysts were expecting as well. And the main reasons for that are interest income on the loan book is better than expected, no deterioration in the quality of the loan book, so they've managed risk. Customers are managing to pay the interest without undue difficulty. They're keeping a good lid on costs, and they've not found any legal trouble, so their litigation and regulatory costs are tiny, so they're keeping their nose clean.
And it's the bread and butter business, traditional lending to consumers and companies, that seems to be making money.
Yeah, all three business sections showed increased profits, but retail banking, lending to people like you and I, was definitely the biggest area of growth. And again, that shows the benefits of the higher margin they're making on their loan book and the fact they're not encountering any difficulties with people managing their debts.
Of course, this week we did have that big deal, the takeover of Evelyn Partners, but that was given a bit of a frosty reception from investors. Why is that?
People can see why the market can see where they're doing it, looking to move even more deeply into private banking and wealth management, sticky customers, consistent fees, visibility of business. But they did pay a relatively high price, according to some. And also the money that they spent on that acquisition means that cash is now not going to be returned to shareholders. The company did announce a big increase in its dividend for 2025 today, but it has now announced one more share buyback for $750 million, but so the next one now won't be for 18 months. So it means a bit more gratification deferred as far as the markets are concerned.
This has been a pretty good period for British banks recently and also for shareholders. I mean, shares have been rising steadily for more than a year. What's going on there?
Part of it is just down to the very, very low starting point in terms of valuation. Banks have been in the doghouse with investors really since the great financial crisis. They've slowly shrunk themselves, cut costs back to health. They're now making extremely high profits, as we've just been discussing. And so, but then boosted by the fact they'll be able to turn those profits into investment in their own business and then really high cash returns to shareholders. NatWest has returned something like 2/5 of its stock market valuation, about £20 billion to investors over the last 5 years. Those cash returns have attracted investors back. We've also realised that the banks probably have indeed shrunk themselves back to health after a very, very long period of time.
And they're not likely to be affected immediately by AI either.
Well, a lot of them will say that they will benefit from it because they'll use it to cut costs, provide differentiated services to customers and be more efficient. Equally, if you take a really, really dark view and say there are going to be loads of people laid off, unemployment will shoot up, you probably wouldn't want to be a lender to people who've already got lots of debts, and you might find it more difficult to take on more. But I think that would be taking a pretty dystopian view of things.
Thanks very much, Russ. That was Russ Mould, Investment Director for AJ Bell.
Yeah, thank you. 22 minutes past seven here on Today. We are marking National Year of Reading, focusing on getting more people of all ages reading for pleasure. Some of the best known authors, as you will know, have been reading from the book that ignited or reignited their love of reading. This morning it's going to be Michael Morpurgo, the former children's laureate, known for books, including, of course, War Horse. He has chosen Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson, first published in 1883 by Castle and Company.
I was at not a very pleasant little prep school where one of the refuges I had was in the library, where it was warm and you could sit on a radiator. And I discovered, purely by accident, a copy of Treasure Island just lying on one of the tables. Picked it up and began it. Now, up until that moment, I had really not been a reader except for Enid Blyton. But when I first read Treasure Island, I realised there was something else was happening here. This writer was enabling me to be Jim Hawkins, this boy at the heart of the story. I was with him, and I remember reading it from cover to cover with enormous excitement, because the characters were not as you thought them to be in the first place. There was something connecting me to this writer and the people he was trying to create. So the deeply unpleasant Long John Silver, he was portrayed to start with as really, you know, everyone's friend and kind, and he was good to the boy. And so you were on his side, and then suddenly, in this little bit I'm going to read at some stage, you discover this man's a monster. And Jim Hawkins, as you'll hear, he's hidden away and he hears it. And I love that. It really caught me by the throat, and I knew that this was fiction I could live in. Now, just after sundown, when all my work was over and I was on my way to my berth, it occurred to me that I should like an apple. I ran on deck. The watch was all forward, looking out. The man at the helm was watching the luff of the sail and whistling away gently to himself. And that was the only sound, except the swish of the sea against the bows and around the side of the ship. In I got bodily into the apple barrel and found there was scarce an apple left. But sitting down there in the dark, what with the sound of the waters and the rocking movement of the ship, I had either fallen asleep or was on the point of doing so, when a heavy man sat down with a clash close by. The barrel shook as he leaned his shoulders against it, and I was just about to jump up when the man began to speak. It was Silver's voice, and before I had heard a dozen words, I would not have shown myself for all the world, but lay there trembling and listening in the extreme of fear and curiosity. For from these dozen words, I understood that the lives of all the honest men aboard depended on me alone. Any writer telling a story has to somehow paint a picture. And the picture he paints of the boy in that barrel, I mean, we're all there when you're reading it. You're absolutely in that barrel. But that's what's wonderful about it. He leads you on and leads you on. You become the people. That's the great thing about fiction writing. He sustains suspense. I mean, the next chapter 11, it begins, "What I heard in the apple barrel." I mean, it's straight at you, "What I heard." That's what we want to know. You know, I want to know what's going to happen in the apple barrel. And that's what he's good at. He's good at leading you on, but then letting you be in the story again. It's the most marvelous piece of writing. It was my favorite book when I was young. And he is certainly still my mentor as a writer.
Michael Morpurgo there on his favourite book. It is 25 minutes or so. Let's get some sport. Mike Williams is in Edinburgh today, but there's controversy in Cortina.
Yes, there is, Simon. You're right. The biggest controversy, in fact, of these Winter Olympic Games in Milan Cortina came to a head yesterday as the Ukrainian skeleton racer Vladislav Hereskyevich was banned from competing. The athlete, who was his country's flag bearer at the opening ceremony last week, wanted to wear a special remembrance helmet during competition, featuring artwork depicting Ukrainian athletes killed during the Russian invasion. But the International Olympic Committee said this contravened their rules on political messaging. Here is their president, Kirsty Coventry.
We've allowed for Vladislav to use his helmet in training. No one, especially me, is disagreeing with the messaging. The messaging is a powerful message. It's a message of remembrance. The challenge that we are facing is that we wanted to ask or come up with a solution for just the field of play. Could we find a solution where we can pay homage to his message, to his helmet before he races? Could we find another solution where the memories could be honored in a wonderful way? And sadly, we've not been able to come to that solution. I really wanted to see him race today. It's been an emotional morning. I think for me, I was not speaking to him in that room as a president. I'm speaking to him as an athlete.
That is IOC President Kirsty Coventry speaking yesterday. Well, we can talk now to the BBC's Richard Winton, who is covering the Winter Games out in Cortina. Hi, Richard. Is this the end of this saga involving Hera Skyvich? Is there any way back for him now?
Good morning, Mike. It's hard to say, to be quite honest. It was confirmed late last night that Hera Skyvich has made an urgent appeal against that decision to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. And now, they can hold ad hoc committees during the Games to hear these appeals immediately. There is, as far as we know, no timescale for that currently. But the more pressing issue is that the first two runs of the skeleton were yesterday and the last two runs are today. So it is hard to see a way how Hera Skyvich can compete in this year's Games.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on that. Meanwhile, Richard, still no medal for Great Britain out at these Games. But could today be the day that GB finally get on the podium? Matt Weston has a significant lead, doesn't he, in the men's skeleton at the halfway stage?
Matt does, yeah. He's in fine form, leads after two of the four races. He's two-time world champion. He's won five of the seven World Cup golds already this season, and he's silver. Got silver medal in the other two behind his GB teammate Marcus Wyatt. So he is in very good shape. I mean, he's as much of a favourite as a favourite can be, I would say. In this race, he goes tonight between 6:30 and 9:30 UK time, and hopes are high here in Cortina that he could deliver Britain's first medal of these Games.
But as we are learning at these Winter Olympics, there are fine margins between success and failure, so we'll be watching that one closely. And if it isn't perhaps to be with Matt Weston, Richard, as ever at the Winter Games, all British hopes lie on the curling. I know you're following that closely in Cortina. Just to bring us up to speed, where are we with the men's and women's competitions?
Yeah, I'm just about to head into the curling stadium for GB men against Italy this morning. The Italian fans are out in force. You might hear their drum band behind me just as they enter the stadium. GB men have played two. They've won two. It's a good start. They beat Sweden yesterday. Sweden and GB are considered probably the best two teams in the men's competition and, in fact, competed in the final 4 years ago. So, strong start for GB's men. 9-round-robin games, two down. Third one this morning. The women had not so good a start. They lost to China last night in quite a scrappy game. They play Korea at lunchtime. They are a longer shot for a medal. I wouldn't entirely rule out them maybe sneaking a bronze, but at this stage they need to do some work to get to there.
All right, Richard Winton, enjoy your day at the curling. Many thanks for speaking to us live in Cortina this morning. You can, of course, watch the Winter Olympics on the BBC iPlayer later today. Just briefly in football, Arsenal missed the chance to go 6 points clear at the top of the Premier League last night. They were held to a 1-1 draw at Brentford. It means Manchester City now just 4 points behind them in second place. And Simon and Justin, you mentioned I Am in Edinburgh. Coming up in the next hour of the programme, a special report on the fortunes of Hearts of Midlothian, who are top still of the Scottish Premiership. Did you know it is 41 years since a team other than Celtic or Rangers, the two behemoths of Scottish football, won the Scottish Premiership? But a lot of football fans in this part of the world, in Edinburgh, are getting very excited that this could be the year, since the first time since 1985, that a team other than the Old Firm win the league. We'll have a special report in the next hour.
Who won in 1985 then?
It was Sir Alex Ferguson's Aberdeen. Who won in 1985, and it has been a long 41 years of Old Firm dominance ever since, but could it all be coming to an end this year?
I feel rather excluded from this conversation. Anyway, fascinating as it was. Thanks very much, Mike. Now, how about some funny things for the 14th of February?
This Valentine's Day, hear a double helping of comedy courtships. Stand-up meets dating in A Match Made in Shalla.
Yep, that's right, honey. Radio 4's going to help me find my man.
Fatia takes us with her on real dates.
I'm going to tell you all about it in my natural habitat.
I need to talk about this on stage. Then we head to the 18th century.
Despite my very best efforts, I remain unwed.
Lady Clementine is looking for love.
I posted a Lonely Hearts ad in the County Gazette. My ad was immediately flagged for misinformation and hate speech. Boo!
Radio 4's Valentine's Day comedy specials. Tomorrow night from 11.
Weather is breezy and wet in England and Wales, later turning drier from the north.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Simon Jack and Justin Webb. The time is 28 minutes to 8. Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
Leaders and ministers from around 50 countries, including Sir Keir Starmer, are gathering at the annual Munich Security Conference. They're expected to discuss European defence at a time when President Trump's commitment to NATO has been called into question. As he prepared to depart for the conference, the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said that the world was changing fast and every country needed to re-examine what its role would be. A key scientific ruling from 2009, which said that greenhouse gases were a threat to public health, has been revoked by Mr. Trump, paving the way for the removal of federal limits on carbon emissions from vehicles. The endangerment finding has underpinned most federal action on tackling climate change. The former president, Barack Obama, said the change would make Americans less safe and less healthy. The government here is consulting on plans to ban vaping in cars carrying children, as well as in playgrounds and outside schools in England. Vaping outside hospitals and health facilities would still be allowed, but smoking would be banned. The leader of the right-of-centre Bangladesh Nationalist Party, Tariq Rahman, who lived in exile in London for 17 years, is to become the country's next prime minister. The party has won a two-thirds majority in parliament in yesterday's election. It was the first vote since an uprising led by students toppled the authoritarian leader Sheikh Hasina, whose regime had imprisoned thousands of BNP members. Ministers have proposed 13 new designated swimming sites in England. They include the first official bathing spot on the River Thames in London and the filming location for the ITV drama Broadchurch in Dorset. The designation would mean regular water quality testing during the summer to give people a better idea of whether it's safe to swim. And the Egyptian government says that archaeologists have uncovered a site of exceptional historic and artistic value in the Sinai Peninsula. The natural shelter features carvings and paintings on its rock ceilings and walls depicting animals, symbols and scenes of daily life from prehistoric times to the Islamic era.
Charles, thank you. 26 minutes to 8 is the time. Last night, the Church of England's National Assembly, the General Synod, formally abandoned proposals to allow blessing ceremonies for same-sex couples in church. The General Synod did vote to continue to look into the issue in the future, but after years of bitter debate, bishops had already decided there were theological and legal barriers to having such ceremonies. Now, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Sarah Mullally, said the discussions had left us wounded as individuals and a church, she said, but the bishop's proposals were a sensible way forward that will take us on to the next steps. Let us talk to the Reverend Dr. Ian Paul, who's an author and theologian, member of the General Synod, and to the Reverend Dr. Charlie Batchick Bell, who is a priest in the Diocese of Southwark and fellow of Girton College at the University of Cambridge. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Justin.
Dr. Paul, first of all, you think they've done the right thing?
Yes, I think they have. This is the teaching of Jesus. This is the doctrine of the church. This is what's said very clearly in canon law and in our teaching. And this is what all of us, Charlie and myself and all the bishops, actually make a public vow to. We say, we were asked at our ordination, do you believe the doctrine of the church? And we say yes. And said, will you uphold and teach it? And we say yes. So in fact, all that's happened in synod is we've confirmed to do what we all promised to do. And I think Sarah Mullally is exactly right. And this is something that those of us who've been resisting those, pressing relentlessly for change, we've said this debate has been damaging. It's damaged people on both sides, but I realize that for people like Charlie who wants to see change, it's been deeply damaging for them. And I really hope that we can put this aside now, we can focus right on other things, and we can stop having these bitter debates.
Can you, Dr. Batchett-Bell?
I don't know which General Synod Dr. Paul was in, because that's not what happened yesterday. It was really clear what occurred. It's really frustrating that after 10 years, we've not got where we need to be. But what Synod had the option to decide between yesterday was, do we continue or do we stop? And with almost a two-thirds majority synod said, no, we want to continue. We're not where we should be, I think. And it's not just people like me who want change that hurt. It's LGBT people who are hurt. And that really wasn't sounded enough in the chamber, I think. But actually, I think we have a real possibility now to move forwards because it's clear that the bishops themselves want to move forwards. This is not going anywhere, and I think the idea it would is just for the birds.
What do you think the next step is then? And let's then put it to Dr. Bell. What do you think should happen now, will happen now?
Well, I think probably what now needs to be done is that the bishops need to decide how they're going to deliver the change. So one of the big problems over the last couple of years is that the bishops have sort of dithered a little bit about whether or not they want to allow particular structural changes in the Church of England and so on. And they've come down very clearly and said, no, we're not going to be doing that. And that's been in the face of a kind of campaign of money withholding and threats and intimidation and so on. They've decided no. So the decision now is how they then move forward. And I think probably that's what the new working group will do.
Is that... Ian Paul, is that acceptable to you?
Well, it's strange. And I think, Justin, you can see the damage this debate has done in that the motion, if you read it, it says in clause B, it says that the LLF process has come to an end. Yesterday in the chamber, Charlie himself was in tears and we listened to him very carefully. And he said that he feels that gay people have been utterly betrayed by this. So it's very strange he's saying something different this morning. And can I also say that Charlie is not, I mean, this is, again, you see, this is the fruit of this kind of debate. Charlie does not speak for all gay people, because one of the things that was really prominent in the debate was the voices of gay men and women who say, we accept the teaching of Jesus and the doctrine of church on marriage. We think it's life-giving. So actually, even amongst gay people in the church, there's a very wide diversity of views. And
answer this to those who are outside the church and watching this debate. One of the things that they will be aware of is that churches change and church teaching changes over time. And they will hear you saying it's in the doctrines of Jesus, and they'll be confused by that, because they'll be thinking, well, there are lots of things that we used to think as a church that we don't think anymore. And this could just be in that category.
Yes, I understand people think that. In fact, I just observe two things. Number one, the Church of England is actually constitutionally incredibly conservative. And the reason is that as the church established by law, its doctrine is actually the law of the land. And you can read the canon law, it's online. And it says that our doctrine is rooted in the teaching of Jesus in Scripture and in the Book of Common Prayer in 1662. And in fact, the church, although the church has varied its administration, hasn't actually changed its doctrine or major issues since then. The second thing I would say is that we always go back, the test for what the church believes, because we are a reformed church, we are part of the Reformation, our test for what we believe always goes back to Scripture, always goes back to the teaching of Jesus. My academic background is as a biblical scholar's professional, and even liberal critical scholars agree that the consistent teaching of Jesus as a first century Jew is that marriage is between one man and one woman. Right. And if we're to follow that, that gives us very little room for manoeuvre.
Can I ask Dr. Bajic Bell, the blessing prayers for same-sex couples that are part of a regular service have been approved, haven't they? It's the standalone service that isn't approved. So why not just take that win?
Well, I mean, I think we are taking that win. I don't know. I'm finding this very bizarre, Justin, to be honest, because whilst Dr. Paul has just mentioned the second clause of the motion, there's also a fourth clause which says set up a working group to progress the work. So I mean, yes, we have...
But
these
that's
prayers,
within the fact that we're not going to change the doctrine of marriage.
But Dr. Bajic Bell, isn't the fact set up a working group? Come on, we hear lots of working groups set up on the Today programme for all sorts of things, but they are a deliberate attempt often to put something off, and that is what has happened here, isn't it?
I think that's one way of looking at it. I think the alternative is that there's a clear, and I think speaking to bishops, there's a clear determination to get this done. I think it's a question of when, not whether. And I think back to your point, Justin, about the prayers of love and faith that are in regular services. You know, it's obviously both theological and just sort of basic nonsense to be able to say prayers on a Sunday morning, but not on a Saturday afternoon. And anyone who looks in on this debate from the outside will see that to be the case. So I think we'll see a large number of clergy just going ahead and doing these prayers in services, which are on a Saturday afternoon.
And in those circumstances, Dr. Paul, what happens?
Well, in that case, the bishops need to decide whether or not they hold their clergy to account for upholding the doctrine of the church and the teaching of Jesus. That's what we all promised to do. And the bishops themselves promised to drive away error and uphold the doctrine of the church. So the question is, are they going to do it?
Dr. Ian Paul, the Reverend Dr. Charlie Batchick-Bell as well. Thank you both very much.
19 minutes to 8. When you think of Patagonia, what do you think of? An exotic, remote land at the end of the earth? But did you know it has long connections with Wales? Welsh settlers arrived there 150 years ago, and two teachers are heading out to teach Welsh as part of the British Council's Welsh Language Project. Anna Chibrando Rees is a Welsh teacher who lives in Gaiman in the Chubut province of Patagonia in Argentina. She told us about the links between where she lives now and Wales.
The Welsh tradition here are very, very strong. Maybe the most important thing to see is the Welsh tea rooms. In every town there is a rugby team. In Gaiman we have one, the team, the rugby team is called Draicoch, like the Welsh dragon. We are so proud of our roots. And the Welsh people who came first, they came here because they really wanted to keep the language alive and all the traditions. For us, it's like an honour to be a part of that, just keep the things alive.
Well, and Harrod Davis is a teacher in a Welsh language primary school and is on the line. And Harrod, you're off there. What are you going to be doing and why?
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm going to be going and teaching Welsh in primary schools there with adults. And also I'm going to be going out in the communities to try and make sure that everybody there has an opportunity to speak Welsh and enjoy the Welsh culture.
Will you be typing people? I'm reading some stats here, which you got from the British Council, saying that over 6,000 people in this province in Patagonia still speak Welsh. So there's a good smattering. You're not starting from scratch.
No, thankfully not. It's absolutely incredible how amazing that the Welsh language has been able to thrive there.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's because the British Council have been doing this for so long now, sending people like myself and another girl called Megan, who's going out there now. They've been sending two people, three in the past, to go out there and just to try and help build the culture and help sustain the language there.
Yeah, I like the idea of Welsh tea rooms and a rugby team in every village out there. I mean, why do you think it's important to be doing this?
I think it's important just the fact that the Welsh language is able to thrive and being able to have like the same sort of culture that we have here over there. The Eisteddfod is a massive thing. So we're just very, very lucky that we're able to have like a home away from home in both areas. For home, it's in Patagonia for them. And then when they would like to come here, it's another home away from home. It's amazing.
Well, I was going to ask that. Is there a return leg where people from Patagonia come over to Wales? And what do they do when they arrive there?
There are possibilities for them. Unfortunately, because of the economic situation, it doesn't happen as often. But when they come here, they can come to the IRF centres. They have, you know, possibilities to go around Wales and see, you know, the culture and the Eisteddfod and take part in that as well.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit about this history of 150 years ago. This was an envoy of Welsh people who were what? Worried that the culture was dying next to England?
Yeah, well, because 150 years ago there was massive things about the language dying out, they were really worried about that. So many communities from around Wales, mostly from North Wales, went over on the Mimosa on a ship. They decided to land in Patagonia and build a community there, and it's still thriving even now after 150 years. So many descendants, even native South American people from the province, are wanting to learn Welsh, which is absolutely amazing.
And are there Welsh names out there as well? Do people name their children that?
Of course. Yeah, there's a mixture of Welsh names, Spanish names, German names as well. So, you know, you've got a range of different cultures there.
All right. Well, listen, when do you leave?
I'm flying out on Monday.
All right, well, the very best of luck. And I say, you see, I've got some mix. We heard a clip there from Anna Chiabrando-Rees. So there you have it, a good mix there.
14 minutes to 8 is the time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning in our Salford studio is Dr. Rachel Mann, who is the Archdeacon of Salford and Bolton. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin. Well, after months of hype and controversy, the day has arrived. Emeril Fennell's version of Wuthering Heights is out in cinemas today, just in time for the Valentine's weekend. Critics report that it takes some bold decisions about Emily Bronte's classic novel, but at its heart is the tumultuous love story of Cathy Earnshaw and Heathcliff. As a picture of love, I've always found the novel disconcerting. Heathcliff is obsessed with Cathy, so much so that he opens her grave after her death and asks her to haunt him. For me, Wuthering Heights is really a genius gothic story about revenge and hatred, as Heathcliff seeks to get back at the Earnshaws for their treatment of him. If Fennell is presenting it as a vision of love for modern times, I'm troubled. Heathcliff and Cathy are not just star-crossed lovers, but toxic ones shaped by obsession. The theologian W.H. Vanstone says, where the object of love is truly an other, the activity of love is always precarious. What he means is that when we truly love someone, we respect their freedom and difference and allow them to be themselves. He adds, love proceeds by no assured program. Love, then, is not controlling or coercive or obsessive, but sets people free. In suggesting this, Vanstone draws on those words of St. Paul. Love is patient, love is kind, love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. Part of what attracts audiences to Wuthering Heights is its intensity, amplified by the wild Yorkshire moor setting. Cathy and Heathcliff might be doomed lovers, but I think we find them deeply attractive precisely because their passion is so charged and dangerous. In contrast, it might seem that a Christian picture of love is passionless and dull. I'm not so sure. St. Paul also says that love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. This is a vision of God's love for humanity, but it also applies to human love. I find this vision alive in a work like Jane Austen's Persuasion. Its lovers, Captain Wentworth and Anne Elliot, take the entire novel to get back together after wounding each other emotionally in their youth. Despite their anger and doubt, their love quietly endures. And as for passion, how about this? Just before being reunited, Wentworth says to Anne, "You pierce my soul. I am half agony, half hope. Unjust I may have been, weak and resentful I have been, but never inconstant. For you alone, I think and plan. A picture of love that, for me, beats Cathy and Heathcliff's every time."
And that was Thought for the Day with Dr. Rachel Mann. It brings us to 11 minutes to 8.
Now, we found out yesterday that the economy had grown by 0.1% in the last 3 months of the year. So not particularly noteworthy, 1.3% for the whole year. But within those numbers was a very weak part of the economy, and that was construction, which fell by 2.1% in that three months, with private housing weaker still, falling 3.6%. And given that the government has manifesto building targets of 1.5 million homes over the time of the parliament, what is going on here? Let's talk to Vicky Spratt, the I newspaper's housing correspondent, also presenter of the Radio 4 programme Housing Britain. And we're also joined by Eleanor Deely, who's the joint managing director of Deely's Group, which is a construction housing company based in the Midlands. Thanks for joining us, and good morning to you both. Vicky Spratt, big picture, build, baby, build was the mantra. What's going on?
Morning, Simon.
Morning.
Well, it was very difficult, I think, for lots of industries, including construction, at the end of last year. Everybody who was buying and selling homes was waiting to make a decision, and the budget that Rachel Reeves chose to have very, very, very late in the year delayed a lot of people's moves. No different for other businesses, including construction. So that could explain these figures slightly.
But construction was much weaker than other sectors in the GDP figures, and everyone had to face that late budget. It was particularly weak in construction.
Absolutely. And the construction industry has taken a hammering in recent years. Inflation has made it more expensive to build homes, more expensive to employ people. And that is no secret. And that is partly why this government has got an enormous task on their hands if they really are committed to building 1.5 million homes.
Is that realistic at this point?
I think that is up for debate. I have spoken to experts who say it can't be done. Several planning barristers told me that as part of Housing Britain for Radio 4. But when I interviewed Housing and Planning Minister Matthew Pennycook, Housing Secretary Steve Reid, they said they expect to see a sharp uptick in house building towards the end of this parliament. Steve Reid described it as being like a hockey stick, like a J curve on a graph. Yeah. It's suddenly going to go up. Is that going to happen? We will just have to wait and see. But what I would say is that hasn't happened in Britain for a really long time. The kind of numbers we're talking about, building 300,000, 350,000, maybe even 400,000 homes a year, that's not really been achieved since the post-war years. Mm. So if they can do it, it will be quite historic.
Yeah, I'll come back to you to talk a little bit about planning reform, which is another big part of the government's programme. But let me talk to Eleanor. You're on the ground there. On the planning front, is there any evidence that the government's trying to bear down on planning regulation being a barrier? Is any hint that is having an effect already?
There are some hints, but not yet consistent evidence. We've sadly seen the lowest outturn in terms of actual planning consents for homes in Q4 last year, just 209,000, rather than the 370,000 homes we need to be consented every annum to deliver that 1.5. We are seeing an increase in planning applications, but that's not yet coming out the other end in terms of planning consents on the ground.
OK, and what is the bottleneck there? I've heard people talk about we don't have enough housing officers, we have enough planning people. What do you think is the bottleneck?
There is definitely a lack of planning officers, but there also is a lack of decisiveness within the system. An average for 51 weeks to make a planning application come through, 94% of planning applications missing their statutory timescale. A lot of that is about people making decisions swiftly, but also having issues in terms of the statutory consultees, getting responses from those, particularly highways and power elements, and flooding is a really a real delay issue in the system at the moment.
Right. OK, so the weather can be quite lumpy, can't it? Being able to get on site, get off site. Can I just ask you this question, though? Is the problem here demand or supply? Is it that you can't get them built fast enough, or is there not sufficient demand to justify you building there? And that might include being able to get mortgages or find financing, or first-time buyers finding it out of their price range.
There is a real issue in terms of the demand side of the equation. You know, for the first time in decades, there's no help for people trying to get on the property ladder. The need is undisputed. You've got 1.3 million households waiting on the housing list and 172 children in temporary accommodation. But there is a viability gap. Currently, there's a 70k viability gap between what an average first-time borrower can achieve and the average price they need to get to buy a home. And we need some government funding, some solution to bridge that gap for the market to work properly.
Well, so some sort of successor to the Help to Buy programme. Let me ask Vicky about that, because that was quite controversial in many ways. Some people thinking that Help to Buy inflated the prices as much as the subsidy towards it, and people found it difficult to sell them on.
Well, there's a few things here, and I'll come back to planning in a moment, if I may. But on this call, from the house building industry for government support to help people buy homes, we're in a really difficult position in this country. And I'm sure everybody listening is aware houses are really expensive. House price inflation outstripped wage growth for decades. Now, for the government to step in and support demand by basically underwriting high house prices, I think that would be a huge thing. I had a story out earlier this week where I reported that there are officials in Number 10 who are quite keen on this idea, but the Treasury are really, really reticent. I interviewed the Chancellor just after her budget, just before Christmas, and I asked her head on, are you going to bring back Help to Buy? And she said, no. But if they're damned if they do and damned if they don't, I think at this point, if they don't we are going to see that people are struggling to buy these new homes because prices, even though they're coming down gently in lots of places, particularly London, they're not going to fall dramatically. But if they do, they really do risk sort of propping up these inflated house prices. What the government are doing is encouraging more what's called high loan to value mortgages. So 95% mortgages. I mean, Santander are offering a 98% mortgage at the moment.
And longer terms as well.
Yeah, so increasing the term so you take up more debt for longer, basically, to make it affordable. I mean, this is where we are, Simon.
Or what we need is a market adjustment, by which I mean a very sharp fall in house prices so the affordability and the price gets back on the same page.
But that is also a problem, right? Because if prices come down, some people who bought at the top of the market might be in negative equity, and that's going to cause a problem too. No. So I think this is a really difficult situation. I do not envy the government having to sort it out. But bringing back Help to Buy is not necessarily a silver bullet. And on planning reform, what I would say is the Planning and Infrastructure Act is an absolutely enormous piece of legislation. You know, it's my job to follow this day in, day out. It's huge. It's introducing some really interesting things.
Is it going to work?
Well, it only came into force at the end of last year and it's still coming in. So I think we'll have to wait and see. But I would watch out for that. Things like Greybelt, you know, this is again very controversial, but releasing what they're calling low value bits of the Greenbelt for building a brownfield first approach, sort of cross local boundary planning. There's a lot going on.
Okay.
So I think in the next few months, it's time to watch those planning approvals and housing starts and see if they can do it. But injecting government money into the mortgage market.
Not the answer you say. Eleanor Deely, I'm going to have to leave it there. Vicky Spratt, Eleanor Deely, Director of Deely's Group. Thank you both indeed.
Very well. Grey belt or green belt? Where is Alex Forsyth for tonight's Any Questions? She is on the line to tell us.
Good morning. Hello, Justin. Hello, Simon. Well, in the week the leader of Scottish Labour called for Keir Starmer's resignation, we are in Dumbarton on the north bank of the River Clyde. There we will find out what people make of it all. On our panel we have Kirsty McNeill, a minister in the UK Government's Scotland office. Ivan McKee is the public finance minister in the Scottish Government. Megan Gallagher is the Scottish Conservatives' shadow housing secretary. And Jerry Hassan is a writer and broadcaster. We are live at 8 p.m. here on Radio 4, or you can listen whenever it suits you on BBC Sounds.
Great, thanks, Alex. Quick, some weather from Chris Foulkes.
Yes, thanks, Simon. And it might get off to a bright start, actually, across the south of England. But otherwise, England, Wales, Northern Ireland, southern Scotland, it's cloudy with outbreaks of rain falling widely. Also, we've got some snow across the hills of southern England. Southern Scotland have the snow, and parts of Northern England too. Indeed, the snow has closed the A66, so we do have some transport disruption due to the snow weather, several more centimetres on the way. The cloud and rain will continue its journey southwards, eventually working into southern England, with the winds picking up across Wales and southwest England later on. The far north of Scotland seeing something of a difference in weather. After weeks of gloom, you'll have lots of sunshine today, but it's a cold and frosty start. Temperatures -8, the lowest temperatures we've seen in the Highlands of Scotland. These sunnier skies will spread across Scotland with just a few snow showers affecting northern areas. It will also turn sunnier for Northern Ireland and Northern England later on today. Temperatures, well, it's a colder day, 4 to 6 Celsius widely, but the last mild day for southern parts of England and southern Wales with highs of 9 to 11 Celsius. Overnight, something we've not really seen this month. There'll be a widespread and sharp frost nationwide. A cold, frosty start to the day tomorrow, but it should be dry and sunny. But then Saturday night sees more heavy hill snow, particularly for northern England and southern and parts of Scotland as well.
Chris, thank you. You are listening to Today on Radio 4.
It's 8 o'clock on Friday the 13th of February. The headlines this morning. The Prime Minister is joining world leaders at the Munich Security Conference for the first big transatlantic summit since Donald Trump's threats to take Greenland from Denmark. Climate campaigners have criticised the American president for moving to scrap limits on greenhouse gas emissions in the US, and the government has put forward plans to ban vaping in cars carrying children in England.
Also in this hour. They're so natural, religiously. A new immersive exhibition on David Bowie coming to London. Will it shine a new light on the musical legend? Plus, Mike has got a special report from Edinburgh, where Heart of Midlothian might be on the verge of becoming the first team other than Celtic or Rangers to win the Scottish Premiership title for 41 years.
I think they seem to have a really good team this year, which is great, and it'd be nice just for it not to be Rangers and Celtic for once.
It just means that it's a change from the Old Firm, constantly winning. I was there when we lost the league in 86, so it's been a long time coming.
The news is read this morning by Charles Carroll.
The Prime Minister will join more than 50 international leaders today at the Munich Security Conference in Germany, the first such meeting since President Trump angered his European allies with plans to take control of Greenland. The US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who's leading the American delegation, said the old world had gone and everyone would have to re-examine their roles in a new era of geopolitics. Speaking in the past hour, Germany's foreign minister, Johann Wadephul, said that there is alienation and irritation among NATO allies about some of the things they hear from Washington. Our Europe editor, Katja Adler, reports.
This year's Munich Security Conference is hugely significant. It's the first big transatlantic get-together since Donald Trump threatened Danish sovereignty over Greenland and pledged economic sanctions against any other country that got in his way. How deeply and how long-term that damaged US-European relations will be under the microscope here. France's President Emmanuel Macron insists Europe must stand strong and separate from the US, while NATO Secretary-General, the former Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte, says transatlantic bonds are as close and imperative as ever. Many others in Europe feel the reality lies somewhere in between. It's seen as significant that the White House chose to be represented here by the US Secretary of State rather than the US Vice President, as is customary at these Munich meetings. Marco Rubio is viewed as a more conciliatory figure than J.D. Vance when it comes to relations with Europe.
President Trump has overturned a legal ruling which limits carbon emissions in the US. The 2009 endangerment finding concluded that a range of greenhouse gases were a threat to public health. The Trump administration said revoking it would save Americans money. The former president, Barack Obama, warned that the move would make them less safe. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
President Trump is calling this the largest act of deregulation in the history of the United States.
This action will eliminate over $1.3 trillion of regulatory costs and help bring car prices tumbling down dramatically. You're going to get a better car. You're going to get a car that starts easier, a car that works better for a lot less money.
The endangerment finding was a ruling made by the Obama administration back in 2009 that greenhouse gases are a danger to public health because of the climate change they cause and therefore should be regulated. Critics say any short-term cost savings for American consumers from scrapping the regulations will be outweighed by the longer-term impacts of climate change, and they've vowed to challenge the decision in court. The US announcement comes as new figures show that after decades of rapid growth, China's carbon dioxide emissions have fallen over a full year for the first time.
The government is consulting on plans to ban vaping in cars carrying children, as well as in playgrounds and outside schools in England. It'll also be prohibited in all indoor spaces where smoking is already banned, including workplaces and public transport. Smoking outside hospitals will be outlawed, as it already is in the rest of the UK. Our correspondent Zoe O'Brien reports.
The ban will cover smoking cigarettes and using vapes or tobacco heating products in children's playgrounds, outside schools and in cars with young people if it's approved. The plan is subject to consultation, but the Department of Health said extending smoke-free zones would protect children from secondhand smoke. Outside hospitals and health facilities, vaping would still be allowed to support those trying to quit cigarettes. Wide open spaces and the outdoor areas of hospitality venues like pub gardens would also be exempt. England's chief medical officer, Professor Sir Chris Whitty, said secondhand smoke could cause significant harm. The health secretary, Wes Streeting, said no child in a playground or hospital patient should suffer because someone else chose to smoke.
The right-of-centre Bangladesh Nationalist Party has recorded a landslide victory in a crucial national election, the first since a mass student uprising ousted the country's longest-serving Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, in 2024. The BNP's leader, Tariq Rahman, is set to become the new Prime Minister, as our South Asia correspondent, Yogita LeMay, reports from Dhaka.
This is a big change of fortunes for Tariq Rahman, who spent 17 years in self-imposed exile in London after being jailed on corruption charges in Bangladesh. Thousands of the Bangladesh Nationalist Party members and supporters were also jailed, including the party's former leader, Mr. Rahman's mother, Khalida Zia, who died of an illness late last year. The BNP had said these were politically motivated charges brought against them by Sheikh Hasina and her Awami League. During his campaign, Tariq Rahman promised that democracy would be restored after years of authoritarian rule under Ms. Hasina. Reviving the country's economy, bringing food prices in check, and generating jobs for Bangladesh's large young population are the big challenges facing the new government.
The former Cabinet Secretary, Lord O'Donnell, has criticised the handling of Sir Chris Wormald's sacking from the post yesterday. Speaking on this programme, Lord O'Donnell suggested Sir Chris had been the victim of anonymous briefings.
Where it's shabby is the fact that they have briefed anonymously against the Cabinet Secretary, saying it's not working. They've been doing this for a long time. This is a process that this government, I'm afraid, is one of their biggest failings. You've seen it right from the start with Sue Gray briefings against her. This is the fundamental problem, and that is something the Prime Minister can solve by getting a grip on his special advisers.
The FBI is doubling its reward for information about the disappearance of a US television presenter's mother to $100,000. 84-year-old Nancy Guthrie is believed to have been kidnapped from her home in Arizona nearly 2 weeks ago. Detectives have given more details about the suspect caught on doorbell camera footage, as our North America correspondent David Willis explains.
The release earlier this week of video images of a masked man on Nancy Guthrie's doorstep minutes before she disappeared prompted thousands of calls to law enforcement tip lines. The FBI believes characteristics such as body language could lead to his identification, and based on the footage, officials have now issued an assessment of the man's height and build, along with pictures of the kind of backpack he was wearing at the time. Hundreds of detectives have been deployed on one of the biggest investigations of its kind, prompting complaints from some that other missing persons inquiries were largely overlooked in comparison.
The government is planning to create the first official bathing site on the River Thames in London. The location at Teddington near Kingston is one of 13 new swimming spots in England that have been put forward for consultation. Others include New Brighton Beach at the mouth of the Mersey and West Bay in Dorset. Here's our environment correspondent, Jonah Fisher.
Just because a site has been officially designated for bathing doesn't mean the water is clean enough to swim in. What it does mean is that the Environment Agency will, during the summer, test the water about once a week and publish its findings. Last year, out of nearly 450 official bathing sites tested, most of them on the coast, 32 were rated poor. The new sites being proposed for this summer include, for the first time, a London site on the Thames, as well as spots along rivers in Cornwall, Yorkshire, Suffolk and Berkshire. Recent years have seen a big increase in the number of freshwater bathing sites being designated and tested, in part because campaigners want to put pressure on water companies to cut sewage discharges and improve water quality.
Team GB is looking to secure its first medal at the Winter Olympics in Italy today. British athletes are among the favourites in the men's skeleton event tonight. Norway tops the medal table, with the hosts second and the US third. One of America's gold medal hopefuls, Chloe Kim, failed to secure her third consecutive title last night. Joe Curry was watching from Livigno.
Chloe Kim was aiming to make snowboarding history, but in the end had to settle for silver. The 25-year-old went into her final run in second place, but failed to land her 1080. That meant the gold was claimed by South Korea's Gaeon Choi. The 17-year-old becomes her country's first ever gold medalist on the snow. Today, Matt Weston could deliver Team GB's first medal at the Games when he goes in the men's skeleton. He underlined his status as the world's best by setting a new track record in the heats. The two-time world champion put down a statement second run to become the only slider under 56 seconds in Cortina. His teammate Marcus Wyatt is in seventh, and Britain's curlers are also back in action this morning. The men take on Italy, whilst the women face Korea after lunch.
That was Joe Curry.
Thank you for that. 8:10 is the time. What should teachers do when a child, perhaps a very young child, suggests to them that they want to change gender? A boy who wants to be referred to as she, a girl as he. It is, to put it mildly, a vexed question in the modern era. The new guidance, which goes out now for a 10-week consultation, is clear about some things. Single-sex provisions like lavatories and some sport is going to remain single-sex. But a change of gender identification should be allowed, the guidance said, if it's considered in the best interests of the child, and parents should be consulted unless it would be unsafe for the children. The campaign group Stonewall says young people who are questioning their gender need to feel safe and supported at school. But another campaign group, Sex Matters, says the idea that a girl can finish school as a boy or vice versa is a dangerous fairy tale. Back in 2023, we talked to two parents with two very different views. First, a mother we called Rachel, whose daughter socially transitioned at school without her being told.
I want the schools to make sure that parents are included in whatever is going on with their children. You know, at the end of the day, she's still a child. I have parental responsibility. It's up to me to care for her well-being, physical and mental. And I have to say, I'm completely horrified that the school did this and kept me in the dark.
We also talked to a father called Mike with a son who identified as transgender.
I think a great deal depends on the individual. I think in a case where a young person is happy to actually come out to their parents, it says a great deal about the relationship with the parent and perhaps how they expect a parent to respond.
In a moment, we will hear from Baroness Spielman, former head, of course, of Ofsted, now a Conservative peer. But first, let's go to Pepe Diazio, who is the General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
Can you live with this? Can your members live with this?
I think we've been waiting for it for quite some time now, so we welcome the framework that we've been provided here. There's no doubt, as your piece has just described, it's polarising. It's a contentious issue which will divide opinion, no doubt. But what the policy recommendations bring to us are some consistency, something that's evidence-based, and something, as you heard from one of the parents there, that puts the child in the centre and makes sure that they're safe. And so I think the vast majority of parents will welcome this and know that they're now part of this policy, and schools will be able to make sure that they talk to parents throughout this process whilst keeping the child safe and making sure that they are at the centre of any decisions that are made.
Is it clear to you in what circumstances it would be right for a school not to tell parents?
Well, as I read it, and obviously this will go to the consultation, the only time that you wouldn't refer to parents is if you felt it was unsafe to do so.
But what would that mean, though?
Sorry?
Yeah, sorry. No, you were going to say, what would unsafe mean in that context?
Well, that would apply in any situation. Anything that you think might put the child at harm or might put the child at risk, and that would apply in any situation to any dealing you have in a pastoral situation with a young person. So this is no different to the way you deal with anything, in a sensible and supportive and compassionate way.
But what if the parents were likely, you believe, to be angry? They had perhaps conservative views, perhaps religious views. Would it ever be right in those circumstances to say, you know what, we're not going to tell them? I mean, is it clear to you whether the guidance answers that question?
Yeah, well, I think obviously it will provide a framework, and having angry parents is something that head teachers deal with on a day-to-day basis. And anger is not a reason not to tell a parent. It's only if something you feel or deem to be unsafe, and that is very different to someone being anxious, upset, or deterred by what the news might bring.
What about the question of whether a teacher now has to use pronouns that are chosen by a child, and indeed other children have to use those pronouns? Are you clear on that?
Well, I think in schools we have for many years now got used to dealing with difficult situations where a parent may say one thing and a child may say another thing. And it depends on the context that we're talking about. So in a social way, then I think there'd be no problem with a choice of pronoun. This is about people getting on together in a school setting.
What about single-sex spaces? Because the guidance seems to suggest, well, does suggest, actually, that in certain circumstances, single-sex spaces will still exist and the biological sex of the child will be the thing that determines whether they're there or not. Lavatories, some sports as well. Jim, are you convinced that that can work?
I just think that's a sensible response. In a single-sex school, the variability and the options open to a head teacher with regards to changing rooms, showering facilities, accommodation that you can have variety within is just more limited. And what this policy does and the guidance does is allow head teachers that flexibility to apply to the situation that they're in.
Papi De Asia, thank you very much for talking to us. Let us turn to Lady Spielman, Baroness Spielman, Conservative member of the House of Lords, and as I was saying, former head, of course, of Ofsted. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Do you think the government's got it right?
I think what we've got here is the proverbial half a loaf that's better than no bread. There are elements in here that are very welcome for schools and will help them deal with some very difficult situations. But there's a big but, or a couple of big buts, and you've touched on them already in your previous interview. The first is that there's far too much leeway for schools unilaterally to decide to permit a child to transition while keeping it secret from their parents. As Cass said, social transition is not a neutral act. Parents may be absolutely right to tell their child that they must wait, but a child who doesn't want to wait may then be encouraged by peers, by activists, campaign groups, influencers, whoever, to go and tell the to go and tell their school that they feel unsafe at home in order to put pressure on the school to allow them to transition.
What should the guidance say, do you think?
Well, the guidance should say that this is a decision which should never be taken without parents' knowledge and agreement. And if a school believes that a child is unsafe and that no conversation with parents can happen, the right thing to do at that point is a referral to social services, because it is only when a child is taken into care that parental decisions can be taken by people who aren't the child's parents. So I really worry that the lack of clarity here, it doesn't say that schools are not required to permit children to transition socially. There's no legal obligation. Only adults can go through a process of gender recognition. So what I think will happen here, we'll have parents who are dealing with a huge range of problems, who've got children who are autistic, have many mental health complications, including dysphoria. And we'll have schools seeing the dysphoria and thinking, oh, we can do something about that. And the child's told us they don't feel safe.
Yeah. Just on that point, it's an interesting point, isn't it, about the range of problems that a child might have in these circumstances. And there's no doubt there is evidence, isn't there? Previous evidence. You mentioned Cass, Hilary Cass, who did a groundbreaking study into all of this, that these problems tend to go together. And gender dysphoria is part of a wider whole. In those circumstances, are you saying that these guidelines don't properly recognise that wider context?
They enable schools to act on what they perceive to be a solution, which may in fact be the problem that the school is looking at, may be something that is part of a much bigger picture where parents and clinicians are discussing, thinking, acting responsibly in the child's interests, and the school is substituting with no clinical expertise its view of what is in the child's best interests. This could drive huge wedges between schools and parents in some of the most difficult cases.
Are you not satisfied, though, that there is at least an effort to suggest in this guidance to teachers that the right thing to do in most circumstances is to involve children? And that you were saying at the beginning, it's better to have half a loaf than a full loaf. That is your half loaf, isn't it?
That is the half loaf. But there's very little, if anything, to help schools understand when and why they shouldn't. And listening to parents is likely to be the best way to find out that they shouldn't. So anything, any mechanism that can be used to make sure that a school doesn't discuss something as difficult as this with parents is problematic.
Yeah. So the draft guidance says, in the vast majority of cases, we would expect schools, colleges, parents, carers to work together to establish what's best for the child, to promote a child's well-being and protect them from harm. So in the vast majority of cases, but that's not good enough for you.
It's not good enough for me. And look across what we've also learned from Cass and elsewhere, how children learn from internet resources, campaign groups. what things to say to get themselves onto puberty blockers, what things to say later to get cross-sex hormones. There is, I'm afraid, a bit of an industry, and there'll be a bit of an industry here in coaching children in what to say to your school to make sure they don't tell your parents.
To a final thought about spaces that are still for one sex, and those spaces, lavatories, changing rooms, some sports as well. Does this guidance go far enough there?
We've got an issue at the moment with unisex toilets in schools, which may be legal but make children uncomfortable. It's this guidance may push schools further in that direction, and that won't necessarily actually be in children's interests. I think there are issues around getting single sex provision right that have still got further to go. There isn't any consideration of fairness, I think, in sport. Because it's located in safeguarding guidance, the focus is now just children's safety. So, for example, in contact sports, but there isn't any consideration of where it's fair to put girls against boys. And there's also no consideration.
So just to spell it out for people who don't follow these things in very detail. So the risk then would be what? That you'd have biological males running in girls' races, that sort of thing.
Well, precisely. You couldn't. You might not be able to say that was unsafe. It might well not be unsafe, like playing rugby might be. But on the other hand, it introduces, from the point of view of girls, a profound unfairness.
Yeah. Okay.
And just one other point I'd really like to pick up is the whole question of compelled speech. This guidance doesn't help schools or anybody who is uncomfortable about being compelled to use the language of preferred pronouns. This guidance appears to leave it open to schools to mandate that for teachers and for pupils. And I foresee that there will be many challenges to that.
OK, well, Lady Smith, thank you very much. Pepe Diaz is still on the line, actually, and was listening to that. Just on the subject of sports, Pepe Diaz, is that potentially a problem, that there could be unfairness? Because this is being seen as a safety thing, and obviously in some cases it will be unsafe and it won't happen, but in other cases, maybe not.
Well, I think that we're right to point to the safety issues, but I think what schools will be doing is looking to national governing body recommendations. So each individual sport will have a range of recommendations around who can play in which activities up to which age and which standard. And so they are best placed to help provide recommendations and guidance to school leaders over those particular issues. I don't see that as a fundamental issue with this at all, really.
What about compelled speech that Bernard Spielman was talking about? So the possibility then that a teacher gets into trouble because he or she doesn't want to use a pronoun that they would say in some circumstances just doesn't conform with the biological sex of the pupil.
I think that schools are really really good at navigating these contentious and difficult issues, and the ethos of a school will come through the inclusivity of the language that they use and the way in which they both welcome and help people feel belong in their own environments. And I'm sure that the flexibility that this guidance provides will allow for schools to adapt within their context and for both their staff and their students to feel like they belong in the establishments that they are in.
Pepe Diaz here, thank you very much for talking to us, and Baroness Spielman as well.
24 minutes past eight. If you are sick of this ceaseless rain, maybe it's time to heed the call of the great indoors. Head inside with a good book, or better still, head for one of the few literary festivals that happen in winter. The Winter Words Festival kicked off yesterday and it runs over the weekend at the Pitlochry Festival Theatre, where you'll find Alan Cumming, actor, writer, producer, presenter, artistic director of the Festival Theatre and host of the Winter Words Festival. He's on the line. Good morning to you, Alan Cumming.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. So tell us, what can we expect to find? What's the draw here?
Ooh, it's a smorgasbord. We've got everything from, you know, big names like Ian Rankin, Amy Liptrot, Nicola Sturgeon, Val McDermid, to Scottish poetry. Hannah Lavery is talking about her new collection. We've got things for kids. We've got lunches where you can talk to chefs about their books. It's the whole gamut, it really is, and some play readings as well, which I'm taking part in. I'm doing one today,
okay,
about Oscar Wilde and Walt Whitman.
And it, I mean, it's a nestled photography at the foot of the Cairngorms, a very beautiful part of the world. What's different about this Winter Words Festival, do you think, to the other literary festivals?
I think it partly is our location. You know, you it is a commitment to come here. So when you come, you kind of have to immerse yourself in like 4 days of, you know, it's a packed schedule of things. And I think it's but one of the things I really want to was excited about when I came to do this job is about the sense of community. You come and you join this community. And it's also lovely we're being sponsored by a local hotel, Pine Trees Hotel. So the community is really involved and really backing this venture. And I think it's something that we have many book festivals in Scotland, but I don't think we have one that is so immersed in the idea of coming together, coming away from whatever you are and joining us in this theatre in the hills.
Mm. I mean, I think that's when you took over about 18 months ago at the Pitlochry Festival Theatre, we wanted it to be seen as a sort of destination place, you know, for the arts. You know, how's that going?
Pretty well, thank you. I mean, I've been really overwhelmed by the support I've got and the kind of the way that people are coming out. We had a festival called Out in the Hills in January, an LGBT festival. This is the second thing of the first year of my programmed work. And we've just been really so happy about the fact that people are getting what I'm trying to do, which is to make this an international theatre destination, as well as bringing international people in. I'm also wanting to celebrate and nurture, you know, new Scottish talent. And this festival is kind of an example of exactly that. But it's been so satisfying. You know, it's been some big changes I'm making, but actually I think people are excited for them and really understand what I'm doing and kind of are coming out and supporting me.
Yeah, I think you said that you're going to be the Pied Piper of Pitlochry and bring some of your famous mates there. Have some of them come?
Quite a few of them have come. I mean, Out in the Hills with Ian McKellen and Graham Norton. This time we've got, Nicola Sturgeon's an old friend of mine. She's going to be here interviewed by Val McDermid on Saturday night. As I said, Ian Rankin, I'm interviewing him tonight. Right. We had Alan Cumming last night being interviewed by the Edinburgh Macker, Michael Peterson. So people are, yes. I mean, if I'm, you know, blowing my little pipe, people are coming, so it's working.
And I just have to ask you about one other job you have. You're the presenter of the Traitors US version, which is obviously, I think, as successful over there as it is here. Are you the Claudia Winkleman of the US?
I mean, I guess. Yeah, yes, I am, I suppose.
And what kind of reception is it getting over there?
It's absolutely bonkers. I mean, it's the biggest unscripted show in America. I saw a thing last night, something like 3.2 billion minutes of it have been streamed. It's absolutely insane. I mean, I think we thought the last season was, you know, really big, and this one's, it's bonkers. I mean, it has really shocked everybody, I think. And in the same way that everyone, you know, loves the show and is overwhelmed with it here, it's, if not, even more so, I guess, because I think Americans are more prone to hysteria. Oh. So it's quite nice to be here in Pitlochry.
Well, I was going to say, just get away from all that hysteria in Pitlochry. Yes. Well, thanks very much for telling us about it, Alan Cumming there. And that, as I say, the festival kicked off yesterday and runs over the weekend.
From Pitlochry to Edinburgh, and Mike at 28 minutes past 8. Morning again.
Yes, staying in Scotland, Justin, for the next few minutes, as we say, because football fans here are starting to ask what, for many, has been unthinkable for decades in Scotland. Will a team other than Celtic or Rangers actually win the league title? Well, this season looks to be the closest any side has come to achieving that. Heart of Midlothian are currently top of the Scottish Premiership table, 5 points clear of second-placed Rangers and 6 ahead of Celtic in third, with 12 games left to play. If they can go all the way, they would become the first club outside of Scottish football's traditional Big Two to win the league since 1985. So, can the boys in maroon hold their nerve?
And that's it! It's all over! The league leader!
I first saw Hearts in 1968. I'd never seen them win a league, so it'd mean everything to me.
I think they seem to have a really good team this year, which is great, and it'd be nice just for it not to be Rangers and Celtic for once.
It just means that it's a change from the old firm, constantly winning. I was there when we lost the league in 86, so it's been a long time coming.
It's a great thing that the old firm's getting challenged, and just hope Hearts hang in there.
After more than four decades of Glasgow dominance, there are plenty of football fans here in this part of Edinburgh who believe this is the year the Premiership title finally comes back to the capital.
And this team is going to take some beating now.
A dramatic 1-0 victory over rivals Hibs in the Edinburgh Derby on Tuesday extended the lead Hearts currently have at the top of the table. They have been top pretty much since the start of the season. So where has it all gone right for the Jambos, as they're known? Well, we've travelled 5 miles or so from Tynecastle to the Orium Sporting Performance Centre, just outside Edinburgh, where Hearts train.
We were a bottom six team last year. There was a lot of feeling around the place of doom and gloom and underachievement.
Derek McInnes is the manager of Hearts, appointed in May of last year.
I felt we could do something this season. But obviously, as the season goes along, momentum, confidence, slowly but surely, win game after game, all of a sudden, there's something a bit different happening here. I think the players start to get that belief in what we're doing as well. But it's more than just a good set of players if you're winning as many games as we've won. It's a whole club working properly.
Hearts have only lost 3 games all season, and if they do go on and win the league in May, it will be their first title in 66 years.
Of course, with 12 games to go, it's there for us. Supporters are entitled to have that dream and keep believing and start getting a bit more excited about things. I think a few people are starting to think, well, surely this lot can't go and win it now.
Shankland, tight angle, scores!
Hi, I'm Lauren Shankland and I'm captain of Hearts. You know, obviously, the dominance Rangers and Celtic have had over the years, it's normal. Growing up in Scotland, being a Glasgow boy, so I know a bit of that. In my lifetime, nobody's quite found the consistency to keep doing it throughout the full season, and that's something that we look to have done pretty well until this point. So if we continue that, then we give us a good shot.
Lauren Shankland, who has just doubled the Hearts lead in double quick time for the title challengers!
There is an excitement around the place, around the city, and for the Hearts fans anyway, there is an excitement. But we as players, we kind of get caught up in that. We need to stay level-headed and continue to do what we're doing well. And if we do that, it gives us a good chance.
We can't stop the outside noise, whether it's positive or whether it's negative.
Back to manager Derek McInnes again.
We've been there for 4.5 months at the top of the league now, so it's not as if it's just a little purple patch. There's something substantial there. There's a body of work there that proves we deserve to be where we are.
You have been a manager in the Scottish Premiership for well over a decade. There must have been times where you and your contemporaries wondered if this dominance, this duopoly of Celtic and Rangers winning the title year in, year out for 41 years now would ever be broken. And yet here we are. It is a club managed by you who are finally the first club in 4 decades to do that.
I've always thought that there would be a team put together who could challenge. I always felt that if a team with enough ambition, enough support, I always thought that maybe that special season was there for somebody. You know, obviously you always hope it's your team that do it, but it's not an easy thing to do. The fact that it's been 41 years. I grew up in that period watching Sir Alex's team win a few titles. I mean, Rangers and Celtic can pay 10 times more than what we will be paying our players.
Tony, a warm welcome to the Heart of Midlothian family.
Yeah, it's really exciting being here in Edinburgh. I've got a very, very warm welcome.
The turnaround for Hearts started last summer when the Brighton and Hove Albion owner Tony Bloom completed a £10 million investment for a minority stake in the club. The businessman said at the time he'd like the team to win the Scottish Premiership within a decade. They could end up doing it in less than 11 months.
Oh, it'll be absolutely fantastic. It'll be parties for months, I think. I don't think I'll go home for about 2 weeks. It'll be great for the city, definitely.
I know we've got big rivalry from Hibs, but I think just as a city, the whole city would be glad that it's not the West Coast that are winning again.
We all know that the last stretch, the final stretch of anything, whether it's a league campaign, a race, anything, is where it matters. But we feel comfortable where we are. We don't feel as if we don't belong there. Is there going to be enough wins? Time will tell. But it's game on, absolutely.
We give apologies to Hibs fans this morning. Edinburgh, very much, of course, a city of two football clubs, but this season is all about Hearts. Are they about to end that 40-year Old Firm stranglehold in the Premiership? Time will tell. They are away, Justin and Simon, to second-place Rangers this Sunday, so a massive game for them. Win that, and they certainly will be one step closer to history.
I wonder how long Derek McInnes will be the manager of Hearts if he manages to pull that off, Mike. Yes. It's very interesting stuff there. Let's take five to hear from Lauren Laverne.
My castaway this week is the costume and creature effects designer, creator of the stage version of Paddington Bear, Tara Zafar.
It was our first preview, and we were just kind of taking stock and thinking, we're about to show him to the world and he's not going to be ours anymore.
About to leave him at the train station.
We're going to leave him at the train station. It feels like everyone needs a nice furry Paddington to love and have in their lives. Oh. And when things get a bit tough, a nice polite bear is what you need.
Tara Zafar, My Castaway, on Desert Island Discs, this morning at 9.
The weather, breezy and wet in England and Wales, but, the but is my insertion, but it's an important one, but later turning drier from the north.
Thank goodness. You're listening today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Simon Jack, and at 25 minutes to 9, Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
The Prime Minister will join more than 50 international leaders today at the Munich Security Conference in Germany, the first such meeting since President Trump angered his European allies with plans to take control of Greenland. The US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who's leading the American delegation, said that he would be honest about the implications of what he called a new era in geopolitics. A key ruling dating from 2009, which said that greenhouse gases were a threat to public health, has been revoked by President Trump, paving the way for the removal of federal limits on carbon emissions from vehicles in the United States. The former president, Barack Obama, said the change would make Americans less safe and less healthy. The leader of the right-of-centre Bangladesh Nationalist Party, Tariq Rahman, is to become the country's next prime minister. The party has secured a two-thirds majority in parliament in the first election since the toppling of the authoritarian leader Sheikh Hasina. And the government here is consulting on plans to ban vaping in cars carrying children, as well as in playgrounds and outside schools in England. Vaping outside hospitals and health facilities would still be allowed, but smoking would be banned.
Charles, thank you. Do we need more women close to the number 10 machinery? Female Labour MPs have suggested, or demanded even, that Sir Keir Starmer revive the role of First Secretary of State and appoint a senior woman to break up what many claim is a number 10 boys' club. Here's Baroness Harriet Harman speaking on her podcast, Electoral Dysfunction, about why having women in the room being part of major decisions is important.
What people say is, if there had been a woman in that room when they were deciding about who to appoint for ambassador to Washington, no woman would have brushed past the issue of the fact that this man, Peter Mandelson, had connection with somebody who had abused young women. It would have been an issue. It wouldn't have been set aside as something that could be brushed past and then just crack on with the appointment.
Baroness Harriet Harman there. Well, Helen McNamara was Deputy Cabinet Secretary in the Cabinet Office during the COVID pandemic and is in the studio. Thanks for coming in, Helen. What mistakes aren't made when women are in the room and why?
So I think Baroness Harman's absolutely right that decisions are made differently when women are in the room. Men and women encounter the world differently. So if you don't have women involved in decision making, and women who are able to speak and are heard and people listen to them, then you're missing out on a massive amount of perspective and you make wrong decisions, whatever they are.
Can you give some examples of some of your experiences during COVID, for example? I mean, what were some of the things that might not have happened had you not been in the room?
Oh, crikey. Where to start? But I think there's something about, if you think about the way in which the restrictions from COVID were unlocked, for example. Around children. So, you know, you could hunt and shoot and go fishing before childcare was properly sorted out. Mm. There are ways in which it's not any group of people, when you have them together, groupthink is bad for government. It doesn't matter what the group is, but groupthink is bad for government. And if you don't have women able to input in decision-making, then you're not going to make good decisions.
I mean, some would say that if you look at the recent clear-out, and that's what it certainly looks like, you've got Tim Allen, Head of Comms, Morgan McSweeney, Chief of Staff, now Chris Wormald, Cabinet Secretary. These are all men who've been shown the door.
They are, but I think if you just focus too much on individual roles, I think you can make a mistake and think it's okay, we've solved the problem because here we go, we've replaced a man with a woman, job done. That's not the right way of thinking about it. So surely what you want is the most talented people anyway.
Did you ever encounter a laddish culture, a boys' club culture yourself?
Yes, of course. I mean, when you work in places where that is the dominant culture, that is what it's like. I think that the point to bear in mind is that if you have, so Harriet Harman is suggesting appoint the first Secretary of State as a woman, have a woman, that's also not the best way to think about it, because you end up with, you know, let's turn to the woman and ask her, but for a woman's perspective on women's things, you've got to be quite careful.
Yes, I suppose that's the issue, and I was probably guilty of that when I said, you know, around the COVID inquiry, you know, thinking about childcare and all that kind of stuff, before we were thinking about you could go playing golf and go shooting, what have you.
Yeah. In the childcare is also a men's issue.
Of course it is, and I just wonder, does it... Some would say that you're convinced it's not tokenism. You're just going to have sort of arbitrary ratios or quotas for the number of people of each sex who should be in office.
And that is just a terrible idea, yeah. Right? And if you think you've solved the problem because there was a man doing a job and now there's a woman doing a job, so hurrah, no one's sexist anymore. That isn't the answer. You've got to make sure that the women who are involved in whatever job are actually powerful, so are able to, in all the conversations, are able to speak, aren't caveat everything they say with, I wonder if anyone's thought, or this might be a stupid question, or no worries if notting. You need to have powerful women who can speak and listen to.
But you've had, Sue Gray was in a very, very powerful position, and by all counts, Antonia Romeo will be going in potentially. She seems to be the favourite pick for the new cabinet secretary. Do you think that this might have been, the number 10, I can just read you a quote from there. The source close to the Prime Minister rejected suggestions of a boys' club, saying there are a number of highly qualified and capable women that work in number 10. You've got plenty of them in the cabinet as well.
You do, but when you get into the rooms of power, so when you're actually inside the room, when big decisions are being made, whether that's, it's usually in number 10, it's really, really unusual for there to be more women than men.
So the actual business of government, when the nitty-gritty gets done.
Yeah, it's not the job titles. It's who's actually influential and who's making the decisions and who's heard. Mm. And in my experience, and I think it's all true, that that will be predominantly men. Now, it doesn't matter. You can have 8 men and 1 very strong woman, and the woman's perspective will be heard. It's right. About power dynamics as well.
It's getting the right people. It's not a question of just quotas or
100%. And not saying that, okay, therefore we've covered the women's issues because a lady spoke.
And so how do you change? Culture is famously hard to change. How do you do it?
I think there's there's openness. I hope that this number 10 for all of us in this next phase is going to be more open, more kind of able to admit mistakes and acknowledge mistakes quickly. You hope, government always makes mistakes, and you have to be able to be honest about that and then move on. And I think you need to bring in as many people with as much perspective as possible and try and open out the conversations.
But just to be clear, you would support the reviving of the role of First Secretary of State, who, oddly enough, was once helped by Peter Mandelson under Gordon Brown, now you mention it. But do you think that's a good idea?
I'm nowhere near brave enough to argue with Baroness Harman. I have wild respect for her. If she thinks that's the answer, I'm sure it's at least part of it.
OK. Helen McNamara, Deputy Cabinet Secretary during the COVID pandemic years. Thanks very much for coming in.
17 minutes to 9 is the time. There were plenty of voices raised in opposition to Sir Jim Ratcliffe yesterday when the joint owner of Manchester United said in an interview that Britain had been colonised by immigrants, we heard on the programme. From United's Muslim fan club, who were swift to say that the boss had got it wrong. He later apologised for offending some people with his language, but there are plenty who think, essentially, that he got it right. The Reform leader Nigel Farage said the comments were accurate if you take the word colonise out. Mr. Farage has been speaking to Nick for his Political Thinking podcast, and they began with what being British means.
It's not some sort of liberal obsession to ask about who's British or who's English. It's an obsession with people in Reform. Matt Goodwin, who you want to be your next Member of Parliament, was a guest on this programme on Political Thinking. He says it takes more than a piece of paper to make somebody British. Suella Braverman, one of your new recruits, former Conservative Home Secretary, she says, I don't feel English, she says. She says, for Englishness to mean something substantial, it must be rooted in ancestry, heritage, and yes, ethnicity.
So that's
not just residence or fluency.
So that's interesting. What she's saying is this. British is a much bigger, all-encompassing term than English. That's the distinction that she's drawing.
But are you?
And hence the reason it's about Britishness. Britishness is a much bigger, broader sense. Englishness, maybe it's a bit more narrowly defined, but I don't think it really matters.
Well, it sort of matters to people, because Rishi Sunak was also on this podcast after it was said of him that he couldn't be English because he was, not my words, but the words of the person who said it, brown and Hindu. He said, of course I'm English, but Matt Goodwin, who wants to be your next MP, suggests he might not be. He says, people can identify as British and indeed English in terms of nationality, but many, and he said Rishi Sunak, are not English in terms of ethnicity. So well, is your candidate right or is it wrong?
Listen, I'm not going to start drawing ethnic lines on what being English is. Otherwise, we'd be back to DNA tests of whether you're Anglo-Saxon. I'm not going down that road. It's about how you feel, and it's about what your priorities are. That's what I'd say. Okay. What are your priorities? What is the thing that you really believe you're part of? And that, I think, is very, very important. Nationality is an extension of being part of a family.
The reason it matters is because of what it might lead you to do in government. And I want to come to that in a second. But you're speaking to me now, hours after you have endorsed the comments of Sir Jim Ratcliffe.
Oh, yeah.
Current boss of my football club, the owner, yeah. part owner yeah. of Manchester United, also very big figure in our economy in terms of what he owns of the chemical industries, not just here, but right across Europe. Mm. I don't want to get hooked on language, but let's remind people what he said. He says the UK has been colonised.
Let's take one word out
by immigrants.
I tell you what we'll do.
Do you take it out because you don't agree with it?
I tell you what we'll do. Let's just come back to that word.
Okay.
What did he say? He said the population has risen by 12 million because of immigration. Fact. Since 2000, he said 2020, that was a mistake. But
it wasn't a fact?
It was a mistake. The population has risen by 12 million. 85% plus of that is directly down to immigration. It is a massive population rise. It has devalued the life of almost everybody in the country. You know, it's meant worse roads, higher rents, less access to public services. That's one thing he said, factually, entirely, utterly correct.
Well, I don't want to get into an argument about the pros and cons of immigration.
No.
But factually, people would say,
hang on,
staffed the health service. Factually, it's treated your mum and dad if they're in a care home.
One in six now on universal credit have come from overseas.
Okay. So there's plenty of good things immigrants.
His numbers were factually correct.
Yeah.
9 million working age people on benefits. Correct, although some of them are in work benefits, just to clarify the position. So all of that's right. And then he said, we've been colonised by immigrants. Now, the word colonised is the controversial bit, which is why he's pulled back a bit from it today. Actually, if you took the sort of dictionary definition of colonisation, I would say that if you go to parts of East London, say just a few miles from where we are now, and you see road signs, you see bus stops, you see underground stations with foreign languages next to them, you think, what's going on here? You look at the last census. There's 1 million living in Britain don't speak English. There's 4 million don't speak very good English. I mean, what he's saying is that large parts of our towns and cities have become unrecognisable as being English or British or whatever interpretation we choose to draw. And the reaction to it has been fascinating. There's a Labour government going, oh, my goodness me, this is awful. You can't say that. We're diverse and tolerant. And what Jim is saying is that mass migration has done us harm and made us poorer. And I think he's absolutely right.
If you want to hear the whole interview, it is, of course, available right now, Political Thinking, which is a very good podcast, as you may be aware. And as Nick is not here to tell you this morning, but he would tell you if you were.
Certainly would.
Yeah, but it, seriously, that interview, that full interview, available now for anyone who wants to hear it on BBC Sounds.
It is 12 minutes to nine.
In Bangladesh, the centre-right Bangladesh Nationalist Party has won by a landslide in a crucial national election. Its leader, Tariq Rahman, set to be the next Prime Minister of Bangladesh, the first election since a mass student uprising ousted the country's longest-serving Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina. Yogita Lemayer, our South Asia correspondent, joins us on the line now. Yogita, it was a surprise.
Absolutely. 2 years ago, when Sheikh Hasina won an election which was widely condemned as being rigged in her favour, I don't think anyone would have imagined a day when her grip on power in this country was broken. But then in July 2024, there was a mass student uprising that ousted her. She's now in exile in India. Her party has not been allowed to contest this election. She's denounced the election. And the man who says that she was the reason he was forced into exile 17 years ago, he was living in London, he's now back in the country. His party has won this election very decisively, and he is set to be the next Prime Minister of Bangladesh. I'm standing outside a mosque in Tariq Rahman's constituency. And I can see lots of men streaming into the mosque to offer Friday prayers. If people were expecting a grand celebration after the Bangladesh Nationalist party's victory in the election. That is not happening. What the BNP has done today instead is that it's told its workers, its members, its followers to offer prayers and to pray for the soul of Khalida Zia, who is the former leader of the party, the mother of Tariq Rehman. She died late last year of an illness. Now, for Tariq Rehman, this is an incredible turn of fortunes, because for 17 years he was in self-imposed exile in London. He went there because he was arrested, jailed and allegedly tortured on charges of corruption. He says those charges were politically motivated and brought against him by Sheikh Hasina and her Awami League party. And now he's back and he is going to be the next Prime Minister of Bangladesh. At their election office, I spoke to the party's main spokesman, Mahdi Amin.
The young people of your country came out in an uprising. What they want the most is democracy, freedom of speech, freedom of expression. Are you guaranteeing them that?
We absolutely guarantee it. Our leader, Mr. Tariq Rehman, his rights to speech, his rights to broadcast his words, that was taken away by judiciary. And most of BNP leaders couldn't talk. We are facing 6 million fictitious cases. We want a new Bangladesh where the culture that we have seen of impunity that disappears, and we have a new culture of accountability, and the fate that BNP had, no other political party should have it.
I know you're keen to say that this is a free, fair and credible election, but doesn't the Awami League being banned from this election cast a shadow on its credibility? Isn't Bangladesh just caught in this cycle and it's not breaking out of it?
We'll go back to people and we'll follow what the people want, but as of now, it's very clear that the people have decided not to endorse any political party who has lost its political character and become a tool which was responsible for gross human rights violations.
The party has made tall promises, and the last time the BNP was in power, which was around 2 decades ago, its tenure was marred by violence and allegations of corruption and human rights violations. And this time it will be answerable to especially the young people of the country who took to the streets, and it's because of that uprising that the BNP has had a chance to contest and win this election. And among them, there is a lot of anticipation, expectation and hope for change.
We want them to deliver their promises to the country and the citizen, and we want them to give rights to women and the marginalized people of all sorts.
I think after this election, Bangladesh will get a new guideline, full democracy, freedom of speech and security too.
Food price should come down so that everyone can have their food properly.
There are big challenges that lie ahead. Key among them, of course, ensuring that there is democracy, that there are freedoms, that people have their rights, but also that people have jobs, that inflation, particularly food prices, are brought down, and the security and safety of minority communities in this country.
That was Yogita Lamaya reporting from Bangladesh. Brings us to 7 minutes to none. Just a word about what is coming up soon. If you want to be eased into your day with some classical music over on Radio 3, apparently you can hear the exuberant and victorious first movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony.
Though you don't have to wait that long. We have a little music for you now. It is 10 years since David Bowie died in January 2016. And now an immersive 360-degree show celebrating his life and work will open in April at the Light Room in London. Here's some audio featured in the exhibition. This is David Bowie performing Rock and Roll Suicide at the Hammersmith Odeon the very night he retired Ziggy Stardust.
Time takes a cigarette. Puts it in your mouth. Pull on your finger, then another finger, then your cigarette. Well, the wall-to-wall is calling, it lingers, but still you forget. Oh, you're a rock and roll suicide.
David Bowie there, of course. Now, Mark Grimmer is the designer of the V&A's 2013 Bowie exhibition and creative director of this new experience. Now, I said quite blithely, Mark Grimmer, that this was an immersive 360-degree show. What on earth does that mean?
Well, I mean, the word immersive, I think, is somewhat overused these days, but it's a show that uses projection and the spatial audio system to essentially put audiences inside David Bowie's creative process and give them an opportunity to experience what it might have been like to witness some of his iconic performances, but also to get to know a bit about his philosophy, to hear about his creative process and to learn a bit about the man as well as a bit about the icon.
Well, that's interesting because he was someone of various guises. You had Aladdin Sane, Ziggy Stardust, the Thin White Duke, all these different alter egos. And that was definitely came through, I think, in your V&A exhibition back in 2013. What's different about this one?
Well, I think the main difference is that the V&A exhibition was a sort of more traditional object-focused exhibition. And what we're doing at Lightroom is using projection and sound really as a primary tool for telling Bowie's story. And what we can do there is use the epic scale of Lightroom to create an experience which people really feel like they're inside. And we've been using footage that we've found in the Bowie archive, and we've created digital versions of objects within his collection to weave together a storytelling experience, really.
And you talk about his creative process. Does that mean, in a way, the distillation of what made David Bowie in all his different guises? I suppose the old David Jones, that, you know, East End boy.
Exactly. I mean, he was driven by this insatiable creative curiosity. And I think that's the thing that comes through across the span of his career. He really wanted to know more. He wanted to learn more. He wasn't afraid to draw from high culture, from low culture. And that kind of act of synthesis, I think, was the thing that made him very special, his ability to draw together disparate elements to create something really new that speaks to generations, regardless of their particular background.
Mark, it's Justin here. You will easily get Simon to come, and you'll easily get me to come. I just wonder about younger audiences. How much sort of cut through is Bowie's genius getting among, I don't know, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, well, younger people as well?
Well, I think he's probably more relevant ever than ever, to be honest. I think people are aware of him through his style, through his music, of course. But I think that what he stands for is the thing that's really resonating right now, which is that, you know, in chaotic and fragmented times, creativity and art is a really great way for us to connect with other people. And I think that message is really, really kind of needed now.
Yeah, I see that you say, some of the notes I've got here with you, saying like, it's like virtual reality without the headset. Is that a good description?
It's not bad. I mean, it's an enormous experience. So Lightroom is a sort of four-story tall concrete box, which is equipped with a lot of cutting-edge equipment to kind of, you know, surround people with sound and image. And I think it does mean that you feel very much like you're inside the story, that you've got material appearing on all four walls and the floor. So everywhere you look, there's something new to discover. And that, I think, is quite a special format, and appropriate for Bowie, I think.
Yeah. A lot of people would think he's got a claim to be one of the most original artists this country has ever produced. I mean, and not only that, he was also quite funny and pretty wise at times, if you remember his famous interview with Jeremy Paxman predicting the impact of the internet.
I think his humour is one of the things that's come through most for me in the process of researching this show. We kind of tend to pedestal Bowie and think of him as this sort of messiah figure, but the truth is he was very, very funny, very self-deprecating, had a great deal of insight, and was quite vulnerable, actually. And, you know, he was struggling to make sense of life much like any of us do. And I hope that humanity, that humour, that relatability is one of the things that comes through alongside the epic performances that we evoke in the show.
Yeah, and for the diehard Bowie fans, are there any, you know, sort of odd bits and pieces you've managed to rake up that people might not have seen before?
Well, there's some very exciting footage that we use in the show that people just haven't seen at all. So material from Bowie's performance at Earl's Court in 1978, which is a bit of a holy grail for fans, but also some footage from the Station to Station tour, some rehearsal footage from Vancouver. So, you know, there's some treats in there for people who might think they've seen everything, but there's also plenty for people who are newcomers to Bowie as well, I think.
Okay. And just to remind us when the exhibition runs to and from.
It opens on April the 22nd at King's Cross, at Lightroom and King's Cross in London, and tickets are on sale now.
Presumably it can't move anywhere. I mean, you've put a lot of effort into it being there. I was just thinking some of these exhibitions do go around the country, but you're not going to manage that way.
Well, we absolutely hope we will, actually. We've got a number of Lightroom venues around the world, and, you know, the ambition is certainly to bring this to a global audience. He was a global artist, and I think, you know, fans around the world would, I think, enjoy seeing it. Yeah.